guarantee the safety of either travelling fans, home fans, or indeed the surrounding local community, and therefore calls for those travelling fans not to attend a football match, should or could be forced into reversing their decision for, well, I don't know, political reasons, enlightened reasons, anti-Semitism reasons. It's perhaps not quite as straightforward a question as some of our political leaders seem to believe. Or, of course, maybe it is.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, is to hold talks aimed at overturning a ban on Israeli fans attending a football match in Birmingham. Supporters of Maccabi Tel Aviv have been told they can't go to next month's Europa League tie against Aston Villa because of safety concerns. Sir Keir Starmer's condemned the move, calling it the wrong decision. Lord Mann, the government's independent advisor on anti-Semitism, has been speaking to LBC.
It is very possible for this football match to happen with tens of thousands of Brummies there supporting Aston Villa, doubtless very passionately and loudly, and a small number of Maccabi Tel Aviv fans are supporting their team. And that's what should happen. I think that's what will happen.
President Zelensky will make the case for US-supplied long-range missiles when he meets Donald Trump later. The two leaders are due to discuss the war in Ukraine at the White House. Mr. Trump's also agreed to meet his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, in Hungary in the coming weeks. Another one of Donald Trump's political opponents is facing a criminal indictment. The former National Security Advisor, John Bolton, has been charged over the alleged mishandling of classified information. The 76-year-old, who denies wrongdoing, could face a long jail term if convicted. The NHS's total liabilities for medical negligence have hit a total of £60 billion. The figure is the sum that would be needed to settle all clinical negligence claims in the system in England as of the end of March. That's quadrupled since 2007, driven by a rise in childbirth injury cases. Andy Morrison is from the National Audit Office.
The liabilities are settled over a period of time. So the NHS settled around 3.6 billion of claims last year, and costs are expected to continue increasing. So by 2029-30, the likely payments are forecast to be around £4 billion a year.
A long-acting injection to prevent HIV is to be offered to NHS patients in England and Wales. It's administered every 2 months as an alternative to the daily PrEP pills currently used to protect against the virus. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was down 151 points at 92.84. The pound buys $1.34 and a euro 15. LBC weather. Another cloudy day with patchy light rain. Some sunny spells possible in southern and western areas. A high of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Make sure you're ready for the hosting season with EE, the UK's fastest growing broadband provider. Get ultra reliable full fiber that can handle...
Mom, what's your Wi-Fi password?
I need to download my updates.
And so all the extra guests can...
stream films in the kitchen.
And go all out on gaming.
Hurry, order today to be ready for Christmas. We'll even make the switch easy with up to £300 towards your leaving fees.
Sounds simple.
Up to £300 credited to your EE account. Verify at ee.co.uk/claims. New customers, 62% availability, 24 months, terms apply.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Minutes after 10 is the time. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, for which I thank you the last time this week. Not to mention the podcast, rather splendid episode of the podcast coming up later, which I look forward to sharing with you. So I'll tell you the first thought I have this morning, if you want, which is how absurd it is whenever people who owe their public profile to their sporting prowess are told to shut up and be quiet because politics and sport should never mix. It's as if people are entirely unaware of the Olympic Games in Berlin in 1936, or indeed of Jesse Owens and of others. The relationship between sport and politics is visceral. It's incredible. In fact, it's no coincidence, is it, that when I talk about the descent of politics in the Western world into atavistic tribalism, I compare it to football. I talk about footballification. The crossover, the intersection, is extraordinary. Did you know that this year Rangers fans were at Celtic Park for the first time since 2023? Because the old firm derby, the old firm clash, was considered by police to be so potentially febrile that it was better if they kept the two groups apart. Did you know that, I'm going to get this one wrong, aren't I? Napoli, I'm pretty sure, and Ajax, certainly two matches in the last round or one of the earlier rounds of the European Cup had away fans banned from attending in continental Europe. And that takes us back to last September. I'll get this right, actually, because it's quite important. Champions League fixtures. Napoli's home game with Frankfurt, Ajax's visit to Marseille last September. Away fans were banned from travelling by local authorities. So when should the police be told to shut up, sit down and do what they don't want to do? 0345 606 0973. I think there is a case. I think there is an argument that should and could be made here. But I think we need to be absolutely clear about what it is. Maccabi Tel Aviv fans were subjected to appalling abuses when they played Ajax recently, but also they embarked upon appalling conduct themselves. That is a matter of fact, not a matter of opinion. There were WhatsApp groups identified calling for a hunt the Jews type of behaviour. And similarly, there were chants from the fans of the Israeli team that went along the F the Arabs line and a glorification of the IDF, who, of course, have subsequently been adjudged to have been engaged in genocide. It seems unlikely to me that many of the fans at the more ultra end of the Maccabi Tel Aviv support are going to have gone along with that decision by the United Nations and a panoply of international genocide scholars and changed their view on the killings in Gaza. So I guess in a way what I'm asking you is, sorry, Ajax, everyone's a bloody cricket. Don't ring in to tell me that I've mispronounced Ajax. I want to know why this is different. And I think that it is. It is, you know, it's just days, isn't it, since we sat here covering that atrocity in Manchester at a synagogue. Days since we sat here marvelling at the terror, or not marvelling, but reeling at the terror in which Jewish people live at times like this. And I'll get texts now saying, what about the 70,000 dead Palestinians? And I understand why you're sending me those texts. But they don't cancel each other out. 70,000 dead Palestinians is a genocide and possibly a war crime. And anti-Semitic attacks reducing the Jewish population of this country to fear and terror is an utterly abhorrent disgrace. It's possible. It's an extraordinary thing to say. After 2 years of covering these issues, it's possible to hold both things to be true. The victims of the terror attack in Manchester are to be mourned and grieved. And the culprit, singular, it's a live case, I won't say any more. I deserve, when they are, and if they are found to be guilty, deserve the... it's one of those occasions where you don't feel the law would be adequate enough. And you can still register the fact that people are currently embarked upon an almost unprecedented mission to dig up dead bodies in a decimated Gaza Strip. And that, I wish it wasn't the backdrop, but it is the backdrop to a lot of the coverage. It's the backdrop to the political interventions, the reason why Keir Starmer has called this a bad thing. In fact, I can't remember the last time all three major political leaders were completely united in the... in the same camp. They're all convinced that the West Midlands police have got this completely wrong. And Keir Starmer, at least, I can't speak for the others, but Keir Starmer actually knows his football. You know, he will be aware of the long and very inglorious history of away fans being banned from games and indeed of matches unfolding behind closed doors. They have a large ultra content, this club, But equally, there is so much anger towards Israel that is seeps and conflates into anger towards an Israeli football club. And that, of course, can seep and conflate into anger at or animosity towards Jewish people, which is the point at which it becomes anti-Semitic, that the police are very, very worried about applying a spark to this tinderbox. So why is this game different? And this isn't a rhetorical question to which I'm expecting you to shout. It isn't any different at all. I just want a better... I think we deserve a better understanding of why sometimes when the police tell the football club, or when the police tell the population that they can't guarantee the safety of the population, whether they're attending the match or not, the scenes in Amsterdam in the Ajax game. I'm going to carry on saying Ajax. You might not like it, but I say Don Quixote. Do you say Paris? When you say I'm going to Paris for the weekend, do you? Or I'm off to Barcelona? Do you? Or do you say Madrid, Barcelona and Paris? So I say Ajax, you say tomato. Take it to the judge. What's the difference? There is clearly a difference, but I want to pinpoint precisely what it is. Because it's pretty straightforward that if the decision here is driven by a desire to prevent attacks upon Israeli and I presume almost entirely Jewish football fans for the crime of being Jewish, then it feels very, very different indeed. It feels horribly different. But where does the principle meet the practice? How do you respond to that by telling the police that they have to go and do something that they don't feel they're capable of doing, i.e. guarantee the safety of everybody present? If, as seems likely, this is a case, forgive me, I think we can be a little, well, a game of two halves, isn't it? If, as seems likely, it is about both the perpetration of violence and the exposure to the vulnerability to violence of the away fans, then the decision becomes slightly different, doesn't it? The decision just becomes slightly different. And I don't have a very strong opinion on this, because I can't prove, and you can't either, what exactly the motivation is. I mean, there were riots in Amsterdam, and there were horrible attacks upon Maccabi supporters. And there were horrible examples of Maccabi supporters tearing down Palestinian flags and chanting pretty hideous slogans. So, why is it different? It's sectarianism, arguably. I don't know what it is. But I do know this. When all three political leaders unite to condemn a decision taken by police officers who are poised to arrive at the front line, poised to police a flashpoint, I wonder where the logic lies. I think Andy can go to the top of the class today. He says, I love you, James, but it's not Ajax, it's pronounced Sif. I think you'll find it Silit Bang, actually, Andy, if we're going to get technical and pedantic about this. 12 minutes after 10 is the time. So, police services across Europe, across the world, and even in the United Kingdom, regularly, or not regularly, but how the precedent has been set when the police don't think that safety can be guaranteed, that they will ban away fans from travelling. The scenes that we saw in Amsterdam when Maccabi Tel Aviv played Ajax, sue me, Ajax, were frightening and hideous. There are plenty of other examples of football violence, football hooliganism prompting either a closed door entirely game or a game where away fans are banned. And I want you to tell me why this is profoundly, profoundly different. 0345 6060 973 is the number you need. 10:13 is the time. I remember when that situation in Amsterdam began to unfold and the story changed in real time. It was extraordinary to watch the shift from the Maccabi fans being entirely blameless and innocent victims of hideous behaviour to a place where it was kind of I don't know, you see, whether it was six or one, half a dozen of the other, or nine of one and three of the other, but it certainly wasn't an entirely one-sided clash. And football fans fight over anything, you know? Football fans in Glasgow have been fighting over different flavours of Christianity and Irish history for generations. And sometimes the violence, the febrility, gets so high that the authorities have to step in. It may be that by 11 o'clock, the story's changed. The story's moved on. The commissioner who oversees West Midlands Police has called for an urgent meeting and full review. But is that the PCC? That's another phone in I've been meaning to have for ages. That's such a weird thing we did to policing when we just allowed any Tom, Dick or Harry to run for election to be in charge of them. But anyway, they've called for an urgent meeting and a full review of the decision to ban away fans from next month's Villa game against Maccabi Tel Aviv. I mean, imagine that the Craig has just toppled Andy at the top of the class. He says, I think you mean kill it, bang, James. Thank you, Craig. I just want you to have one thought in your mind before we get stuck into this. And it's this. What if the game goes ahead and the ban on the away fans is lifted and we have scenes in Birmingham that are akin to the scenes that we had in Amsterdam and we know that it could have been completely avoided? What will the barroom lawyers and the tin pot columnists be saying then? I don't know, but they'll probably try and blame it on Keir Starmer and quite possibly Gary Lineker. I also think that some people need a little bit of help understanding why this club and this game at this time do deserve different treatment from any other club at this time. When it comes to the reasons behind potential violence, some reasons are more important than others. For example, anti-Semitism is more important than centuries-old arguments about different flavours of Christianity or the history of English oppression in Ireland. In 2025, I'm talking about. This would be interesting, won't it? Hit the numbers now, you will get through. But just so you know, if you don't say Ajax, I will be correcting you.
LBC.
Timeless designs. Prestigious living. Where heritage meets home. Headley Chase. An elegant collection of 2, 3, 4 and 5 bedroom homes in the heart of Surrey. With great travel links, a superb cycle network and all of life's conveniences nearby, it's truly a home for everyone. Launching in Headley, Surrey on Saturday the 25th of October, reserve your place at the launch event and be among the first to discover these exclusive new homes at Headley Chase. Find out more at headleychase.com.
Sophie, Tom and the kids are standing by the luggage carousel waiting for Sophie's bag. Looks like she's going to be wearing Tom's clothes for a week, but she's not worried. Their HSBC Premier Bank account has comprehensive worldwide travel insurance that covers them, the kids and grandkids, if they had them. Everything's Premier when your bank account is. Search HSBC Premier. HSBC UK, opening up a world of opportunity. Apply with £100,000 annual income or £100,000 savings or investments with HSBC UK or Premier Status Abroad. Cover provided by Aviva Insurance Limited. Age restrictions and limitations apply.
Every try. Every tackle. Every thunderous roar. Live. Be there as the England rugby team take on Australia, Fiji, New Zealand and Argentina at Allianz Stadium in the Quilter Nations Series. Witness the likes of Maro Itoje, Marcus Smith and Tom Curry every weekend in November. Tickets are selling fast with prices from £50 for adults and £15 for juniors. Visit englandrugby.com/tickets.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
1018. We can't guarantee the safety of the local population, never mind the rival football fans. Therefore, we're banning the away fans from coming. In many other circumstances, that would be an uncontroversial decision. In this circumstance, when the away club is Maccabi Tel Aviv, an Israeli club, with a well-established and quite infamous hardcore of ultras, if you're new to this topic, it's a kind of slightly unhelpful and euphemistic phrase that is given to the extreme fringes of hooliganism. Ultra-hooligans, if you prefer, that's probably the easiest way to understand it. But because an Israeli football club will also be blamed by many people or held responsible by many people for the actions of the Israeli government. And that, as we have seen many, many, many times in recent years, bleeds hideously into anti-Semitism. That stupid Oxford student. I don't know if you saw that. I mean, the idea that you would be calling for Zios to be put in the ground while the memory of the synagogue attack, the terror attack on the synagogue in Manchester wasn't just fresh. It was still front and center in the minds of many, many people, whether they were Jewish or not. But if you were Jewish, it would have been hard to think about anything else. And then some spotty person from Oxford University starts chanting obviously insightful and anti-Semitic hate on the streets of London. You know that actually this is different. But how? Gavin's in South Shields. Gavin, what would you like to say?
Morning, James. All right, long time listener, first time caller.
Welcome.
I'm on granddad duty today. I'm off work today, so if you hear a little boy babbling in the background, that's what it is. But basically, I think it's not a footballing rivalry decision. I'm a Newcastle fan. And I've been to games, Newcastle versus Sunderland. In fact, the last game we played them, to go to the game, the police decided that we had to go to travel to Newcastle's ground, get buses, 6,000 of us taxi in the ground, held back after the game, then back to Newcastle. So we weren't allowed to mingle with the locals, if you like. And that's probably, it's a footballing decision based on rivalries and stuff that's gone on in the past. This decision isn't a footballing rivalry decision. This one, it's what's going on in the world at the moment. It's purely based on the knife edge that Birmingham's on, probably, and the knife edge that Israel's on at the moment, you know. So it's the right decision. And I think the politicians sort of getting involved to say, okay, we should reverse this. They're just saying, okay, let's let it go ahead and let's see what happens type thing. It's dangerous. It's dangerous to do that.
Well, what do you say to the very powerful point that it sends a message that there are some parts of this country where on some nights Jewish people are not welcome?
It's just the wider picture, isn't it? The whole sort of, you know, patriotism that we're all involved in and stuff like that. You know, where I live, the place I was brought up in, you know, the flags on the lamppost, my heart sinks every time I drive there. I was brought up on a lovely estate, and now it's full of people like that. And it's this undercurrent of, you know, I know that the same mainstream media and stuff like that. It's the undercurrent of what people are believing, what they're reading, and not doing a bit of research. And this is what's happening, that, you know, people all of a sudden become anti-Semitic because of what's going on in Israel. And it's not every Israeli, it's not every Jewish person that's like that, you know what I mean?
And desperate attempts to portray anybody expressing solidarity with Palestinian people as a Hamas supporter are pretty unhelpful as well. But
I think it's disgraceful.
I thought you were going to go the other way. I thought you were going to say that because this isn't a footballing rivalry, the police should not ban the away fans. Because the other examples that we've looked at have been where the hooliganism, the battlefield, if you like, has been. I mean, you'd stretch it probably in the range of Celtic history, which is not, it's somehow beyond footballing rivalry, isn't it? But the argument that the politicians have is that the message it sends out is that the United Kingdom has spaces where Jewish people are not welcome. And I wonder if that's a conflation. Actually, it has spaces where supporters of a football club with a long history of violence are not welcome. And that violence cuts both ways. A long history of being targeted unfairly and of behaving unfairly are not welcome because, as you say, of the current geopolitical situation. What club are you raising the grandson to support, Gavin?
Newcastle. I've got three grandsons, all Newcastle fans. I've been to games as well.
What would happen if one of them went Sunderland or one of them decided to?
Well, that's the thing. My sister supports Newcastle and she's married a Mackenzie Sunderland fan. And
there we go.
She's got a daughter who's a Newcastle fan and a son who's a Sunderland fan. So it's kind of funny. But it's the whole thing about how football fans are treated as second class citizens. That's a wider discussion for another time.
Yes, it is, and it's not really one for this radio station because there are other ones dedicated to sport. But I like that subject. I was chatting to a colleague earlier who's never been to a football game in his life, but was recently witnessed the policing of a Crystal Palace game, and he couldn't believe the way that the police treated the fans. It's as if when you're a football fan, you're guilty until you're proven innocent.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, the amount of searches sometimes you've got to go through before you get into games, you know what I mean? And I've had it where my wallet's been taken off us, and they've searched my wallet to check if there's anything in my wallet. That was at Burnley. But I've just been away to Belgium in the Champions League when we played in Belgium. And it was really well policed, and the police were really good. But they were the riot shields and the helmets and the batons, and they were lying in the streets, and you couldn't sort of mingle with the locals once you were sort of near the ground. We haven't got a reputation for fighting, you know what I mean? I think it's just the reputation precedes you, that's what it is. And
it is the case that in September two other away teams were told that they couldn't take any fans with them because the local police felt that they weren't up to, they couldn't guarantee the safety of the population. And if that's the rationale for it, then I need someone to explain to me why that is trumped by the other issues that we're discussing here. Why the police should be told to do their best, regardless of their conclusion that they can't guarantee the safety of the population. Or, when Keir Starmer sticks his oar in, does he provide £5 million to Birmingham Council? Because it's, of course, I mean, bankrupt, isn't it, Birmingham Council? They've got enough money to pay the bin men. That's a slightly provocative political comment, but you see what I mean. You know, the politics, easy to pontificate on this when you're not responsible for the policing. If it goes ahead with a police service that don't feel they can guarantee the safety of the people and their worst fears turn out to come true, who wins? Who wins? 0345 6060973. Thank you, Gavin. Peter's on the Wirral. Peter, what's going on?
Thanks, James. Yeah, good morning.
Hello.
I've been following the story a little bit since it started last night.
Yes.
I have a great deal of empathy with the Birmingham police. From what I've read and understood of it, that they've taken it as a purely public safety issue, which is their job. They don't do politics, they do public safety. And with previous evidence that they have judged, it would be very difficult to guarantee public safety. And in lots of cases, as you've already discussed, around Europe and in this country, it's happened before. For public safety reasons, it's either behind closed doors or one set of fans, maybe, you know, I mean, I won't go back as far as to talk about some of our own teams, especially the lower leagues, but I think it's happened. I think what the problem is, the police have raised an issue and said, this is what we believe. And in my interpretation, the politicians on all sides now have jumped in because it's a very sensitive subject. And they've all jumped in and said, it's anti-Semitic. And so it runs down a completely different
rail. Do you think they're saying the decision is anti-Semitic? The decision to ban the away fans is anti-Semitic?
I do. Okay. I think that's the inference.
It might be the inference, but it's not what they've said. I mean, No, you don't need to apologise. I just need to clarify what you were saying. So, a lot of the animus directed at an Israeli football club at this time will be anti-Semitic in essence or in intent. But equally, this is not a club that has a very proud track record of bringing peace and harmony in its wake wherever it may travel. And so some of the chants in the context of the decision taken by the United Nations Commission that Israel has been committing genocide, some of the chants that the hooligans from Maccabee have made in the past would be pretty close to hate crimes in the context of that judgment, albeit that the British government hasn't endorsed the decision. So there's a million reasons why the police would say, we're not sure we can keep a lid on this one, lads. And it seems to me, and to you, I think, that Keir Starmer is saying, I don't care, take the lid off.
That's right. And I've just been having a brief communications with my son over this subject.
Yeah.
So if I was the head of the Birmingham Police now, I would make a public statement saying, this is our assessment as the experts in this area. If you think it's going to go ahead, fine, let it go ahead. But whatever happens, it's on you guys, not us. That's what I'd say to him. And make them take ownership of it. Because this is what they tend to do, is they say, oh, you must let this go, you must let that go. When it goes wrong, they all turn their backs and go, oh, the police must have messed it up. It's really, really disingenuous of the MP, of the political parties.
You know how my mind works. There's a part of me that thinks if all three of them are united, then they must be right. And a part of me that thinks if all three of them are united, then it's my job to start picking holes in the argument. I don't know which side of me is going to prevail today, Peter. Did you say you were having beef with your boy about it? That you were disagreeing?
No, we were just having a chat about it. We have some quite robust political discussions, which is quite good. But we're on the same vein with this. We're on the same.
Well, that's the bit that's missing from the analysis so far, isn't it? Is the reason why it is wrong of you and your son to see this through the lens that you're seeing it through, which is quite pragmatic and rational. And it is right to tell the police that even though they're not sure they can guarantee the safety, they have to go ahead because ... Or someone has to front up the money to put an incredible operation on the grounds, on the streets of Birmingham and the environs of Villa Park, in order to ensure that the dog doesn't see the rabbit and the rabbit doesn't see the dog, that neither side, if two sides appear on the night, are going to be able to get close to each other, which is doable, but hugely, hugely expensive. We've got an idiot's corner. Steve, well done, mate. There'd be a struggle today. Steve has written, uncontrolled mass migration has brought sectarian politics to Great Britain. I tell you what, mate, when you find out about this little place called Scotland, you're going to have an embolism. Absolutely extraordinary. Here's Thomas Watts with your headlines.
UEFA has urged authorities in Birmingham to ensure Maccabi Tel Aviv fans can attend next month's match against Aston Villa. Israeli fans have been banned from the tie for safety reasons, but ministers are looking at ways to reverse the decision. Volodymyr Zelensky and Donald Trump will meet at the White House this afternoon. They are expected to discuss the possibility of the US supplying Ukraine with long-range Tomahawk missiles. Veterans are now able to apply for an optional digital version of their identity cards. The smartphone-based ID is designed to give former military personnel an easier way to prove their status. LBC weather, another cloudy day with patchy light rain. Some sunny spells possible in the south and west, a high of 17 degrees.
This is LBC.
With the long, hot summer still fresh in the memory, it's easy to forget what's around the corner. Prepare your BMW for whatever the great British weather can muster with a BMW seasonal inspection. For just £39.99, our expert technicians will top up fluids and oil, check the essentials like tyres, wipers and battery, and return your BMW washed, vacuumed and winter ready. Search BMW seasonal inspection. T's and C's apply.
We had our smart meter installed a year ago, and it's made things so much easier. Not having to submit meter readings or having to deal with estimated bills is great.
A smart meter sends meter readings direct to your energy supplier. It means you get accurate bills, not estimated bills, and you don't even need an internet connection. Call your energy supplier to request a smart meter today.
Real testimonials voiced by actors. Eligibility may vary.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging, or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep. Where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters. On your doorstep. Based on 2024 UK and EU Amazon packaging data.
Would anyone like some Bourneville dark chocolate?
Is it so dark the aftertaste lasts for a week?
No.
Does it taste really, really complicated?
What? Is it saturated in nibs?
So dark it comes with a therapist?
To the uneducated palate, does it taste like burnt tyre?
Would scientists compare the taste to dark matter?
Is it artisanal, in all caps?
Are the tasting notes gloom?
No, no pretentiousness, no complexity, no bitterness. Just smooth dark chocolate from Cadbury. Cadbury Bourneville, made to be enjoyed, not endured.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60
973. 10:33 is the time. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. So last November, when the Israeli football club Maccabi Tel Aviv visited Amsterdam to play against Ajax, or Ajax if you prefer, there were hideous scenes, and nobody disputes that some of those scenes were absolutely anti-Semitic. Their people were being attacked because they were perceived to be Jewish by people who bore them ill will and hatred simply by dint of them being Jewish. That is, I think, an established fact. I don't think that's even vaguely controversial. The mayor of Amsterdam made it clear that that was his view, and some of the footage made it clear that that was the case. On the other hand, for want of a better phrase, there's also footage of Maccabi fans tearing down a Palestinian flag, reports of fairly hideous chants being engaged in, and violence and hooliganism and the burning of a flag as well that are well recorded. So if Birmingham police had taken a decision to ban the away fans from this game against Villa solely because they were worried about anti-Semitic violence, we'd be having a different conversation. It would be the same question, but it would admit different answers because it would feel like a surrender to anti-Semitism, right? But, as I just said, there is another hand, and it is that this club bring violence and disharmony in their wake. And also, of course, that some many people, probably rather underrepresented in the UK media, which in part explains much of their frustration, are suffering from a form of trauma, having witnessed secondhand the events in Gaza over the last 2 years, the genocide in Gaza. The fury that people feel, the horror that people feel about that is part of this conversation. It does not excuse any outpourings that breach the law or breach common decency, but you can't ignore the scale of heartbreak and anger. And you don't have to be Yoda to understand the relationship between those two things. And fear, of course, which cuts both ways. But for every political leader in the country to call for this ban to be lifted makes me, a sort of naive little lemming that I am, makes me think that they must have a point that we're missing. And the only point I can currently see is the one that says the fear of violence, the threat of violence, is so completely, if not one-sided, then so completely skewed towards anti-Semitic attacks upon Israeli football fans who are likely to be cheering for the military forces that have undertaken a genocide. I find every avenue that I start going down is almost impossible to navigate. And that's why I mentioned the politicians, because surely they've got a clear view on this, which I can't currently see. 0345 6060 973 is the number you need. 10:36 is the time. Pepe's in Chippenham. Pepe, what would you like to say?
Hello, James. First time call. I'm a bit nervous.
Well, okay. That's only me. It's only me. Welcome,
hello,
Pepe. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you. So I just wanted to make a point. So I'll give you an example that just happened on Tuesday this week. This is a EuroLeague basketball match. I'm more of a basketball fan than a football match.
Okay.
I'm from Valencia, Spain. Careful how you pronounce Valencia, please.
You beat me to it. Go on.
It was Valencia basket against Hapoel Tel Aviv.
Right.
And for obvious reasons, in my opinion, the officials, the police force, they decided that the best thing to do was not to hold the game under closed doors. So there was no fans whatsoever from either party. So I think, you know, the population should just take what the officials are saying.
I get that. It's a good point, and it's a helpful bit of precedent. There's another one, actually, from Villa when they were playing against, was it Warsaw a couple of years ago? I think it's Legia Warsaw. I'm going to get picked up on my pronunciation of that as well. David reminds me that the fans, even with a ticket, couldn't get in 2 seasons ago because of crowd disturbances immediately before the match. The away end was completely empty. But what if the message is this? Because this is the message a lot of people are hearing, and I don't know that they're wrong. And we can't guarantee that we can protect you from anti-Semites. To which the response is, you have to. And I would very much man the barricades that say, you have to.
Well, if you are, just say you are an employer, for example.
Yes.
As an employer, you've got a duty of care. So I think the police have got a duty of care towards the population. And they've taken the view that there is a risk for whatever reason. It might be because anti-Semitism chant or whatever it might be.
Yes.
There's a risk to the, you know, to the wider population. So why take the risk?
That's the question that no one's answered yet, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is why take the risk? And all I've got, and I mean this actually, if we could prove beyond reasonable doubt that the actual subtext here is we can't guarantee to protect people from anti-Semitic attacks, my position would be you have to. But on the practicalities of it, I've got nothing.
I don't think they can protect everyone.
But if it was an entirely one-sided threat, I would argue, perhaps a bit foolishly, I would argue that then you have to. But if it is swings and roundabouts, you know, if there is violence inflicted and violence endured, violence suffered, if there is hatred disseminated and hatred endured, then the policing decision looks a bit more straightforward to you and to me than it apparently does to Keir Starmer and Ed Davey and many others as well.
What I would say ultimately, this is just a sport, and I don't think we should put the strain on the authorities just because of a sports match. I think it's ludicrous that there's more important things for the police to deal with.
I mean, it also, it also speaks to this extraordinary kind of fudge that the United Kingdom is suffering from at the moment on a lot of these issues. Because if the United Nations Commission is correct, and if the International Criminal Court is correct, and the allegations of war crimes against Benjamin Netanyahu are justified, are subsequently upheld, and the genocide that's unfolding in Gaza is historical fact, then there would be many, many more arguments about whether teams from that country should be competing anywhere in much the same way that Russia and Russian athletes have been sanctioned. But that, of course, is a Pandora's box that no politician in Britain is going to want to open. And frankly, nor am I. Pepe, thank you. So give my regards to Valencia, yeah?
Say that again, sorry?
Give my regards to Valencia.
Yeah, I will do. But the only thing that what I say is that politicians shouldn't get involved on this. They should just take the experts' advice.
There aren't many areas in which we'd be calling for politicians to overrule the police, are there? That's another really good point. In fact, it reminds me of the story that we were doing yesterday regarding the China spy case. Pepe, thank you. I have a number in front of me. I don't know if you were listening yesterday. I was very proud of yesterday's show because we did a topic based on the premise that it wasn't a topic. It's a news story and it belonged in the bulletins and Thomas Watts absolutely smashed it, as he always does. But in terms of phone-ins, of which I like to think of myself in the words of Daddy Pig as a bit of an expert, it's not a phone-in. The China spy case, for the simple reason that nobody knows what's going on, and even those who do don't really care. So it was an extraordinary bubble of media and politics, largely, I think, because the right-wing media, the bent media, and their friends in the Conservative Party thought that they might be able to beat Keir Starmer over the head with it without really knowing what the weapon was. Listen back to PMQs on Wednesday, knowing what you know now, and you have Kaby Badenoch hitting Keir Starmer over the head with what she thought was a truncheon, but actually turned out to be a soggy old balloon. And it worked as a phone-in, in the end. I kind of proved that nobody had anything to say. And then we took a couple of calls from people who unintentionally proved that nobody had anything to say. Then we had a couple of calls that were actually quite interesting, but not enough to justify an entire hour of radio. And then we moved on to something else. I have in front of me the polling from YouGov on how closely, if at all, you have followed the collapse of the case of two people accused of spying in the UK for China. Now, if you were relying upon His Majesty's media to convey to you how important this story is to His Majesty's subjects, you would probably put the number of people following it either very closely or fairly closely in the high 20s, low 30s. I mean, how many people have been following it very closely? Judging by the amount of front page coverage that it's got and Kemi Badenoch's decision to dedicate the whole of PMQs to it, I'm going to go with 28%, James, very closely, and 30% fairly closely. So 58% in total. I have in front of me the numbers that actually have been following the collapse of the case of two people accused of spying in the UK for China fairly closely, very closely, not very closely. And I am aware of the story, but I am not following it, and I am not aware of the story. Which do you think is the highest number out of all those positions? I'm following it very closely. I'm following it fairly closely. I'm following it not very closely. I am aware of the story, but I'm not following it, and I'm not aware of the story. Which one do you think is the biggest constituency? I'm not going to tell you before the next break, so I want you to chew on it for a while, because I'm going to tell you exactly what has happened. Given how few people, spoiler alert, given how few people have been following the story closely, I think it's my job on this occasion to explain to you what has happened. So the Tory media, in the last 24 hours, last 48 hours, have shifted from hysterically claiming that Keir Starmer did intervene in the China spy case to hysterically claiming that Keir Starmer did not intervene in the China spy case, but jolly well should have done. And that is what I mean when I tell you how broken the media is in this country, when I talk about client journalism and tribalism and footballification and the ludicrous attempts to portray absolute nonsense as fact or reality. That Daily Mail column a couple of days ago saying Keir Starmer's going to have to resign because he's lied. So persuaded were they that he had intervened in the China spy case, and now it turns out that he hasn't. Pretty much categorically true, but never say never in UK politics that he hasn't. Now they're pretending to be furious that he didn't intervene. Take that one to the bank. What were you cross about on Wednesday? Oh, Keir Starmer intervened. What are you cross about on Friday? Keir Starmer didn't intervene. Okay, how does Keir Starmer come out of this well in your mad world? It's 10:45.
Sunday with Lewis Goodall.
Bridget Phillips, an education secretary. Do you think that the Gaza process should continue to go ahead?
I do recognise why over many, many months people have taken part in protests, because they see appalling suffering. I would urge people just to reflect on the impact that protest can have. Just because you have the right to protest doesn't mean that you have to protest in all circumstances.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Stephen Gethins, who's SNP Foreign Affairs spokesperson. Are you keen to have another endless conversation about independence, because you're so afraid of your own domestic record after 17 years in office?
The Scottish government does not have the same powers as the UK government.
You've got the most powerful subnational parliament in Europe.
That's garbage. I'm sorry.
Sunday with Lewis Goodall. Sunday morning from 10 on LBC.
Sharing intimate photos of her without her consent.
Unwanted touching. Unwanted comments. Unwanted nudes.
Controlling what she can and can't wear.
Controlling who she can and can't see.
Threatening her.
Enough. This is abuse.
If you think it's wrong, act on it.
Call it out, show support, report it.
There are many ways you can safely tackle violence against women and girls. Find out how at gov.uk/enough. If someone is in danger, call 999.
Mark's best friend Ben follows him around. Ben's there when he wakes up in the morning. He's there when he goes to the pub. He's there at dinner time. He never leaves him. Ben died in Iraq in 2004. The trauma of that day has never left Mark. For many, the battle continues. Combat Stress provides intensive mental health treatment to UK veterans with complex mental health problems. Combat Stress, for veterans' mental health. Search Combat Stress to support our work.
Imagine the very focal lens of the future, personalized to you, engineered with artificial intelligence and powered by your visual behavior. Experience instantly sharp vision in motion with Varilux XR Pro lenses from Essilor. Find your local optician at Essilor.com and ask for Varilux XR Pro.
Your daily life often goes like this. With Air France, choose instead. Until the 21st of October, put your daily life on hold. Take advantage of Air France moments and book your flight to St. Martin from £679 flying from London Heathrow via Paris. Return including tax. Elegance is a journey. Air France. To book and for terms and conditions, visit airfrance.co.uk.
Stayshore. What is Stayshore? Stayshore is not just the UK's favourite travel insurance. Stayshore is the confidence that comes with knowing that you're covered by the company with more five-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other provider. a company that welcomes people of all ages with pre-existing medical conditions for single or multiple trips. So stay sure with Stayshore Travel Insurance. UK's favourite relates to number of 5-star Trustpilot reviews, T's and C's and verifications at stayshore.co.uk/reviews.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
Just like a bit of an aside. It's extraordinary how many of my listeners know a heck of a lot about football, but obviously choose not to listen to radio stations or radio programmes that are dedicated exclusively to football, of which there are many. It's just schooling me left, right and centre. I don't think I even knew this, because it doesn't really involve football at the level that I follow. But it knits together quite a few strands of the conversation that we've been having today. It even brings Pepe's hometown of Valencia into the picture, because UEFA banned Ajax fans from a Champions League game at Stamford Bridge in 2019. It followed crowd trouble at a previous fixture. At Valencia. I we can't do a phone-in on that, can we? It's one of the most... The cleverest person I've ever met was my English teacher at school. She was still is a magnificent woman in every imaginable way. And she very, very, very rarely got opinionated. She had opinions, but she never really got kind of... she was super zen, is what I'm saying, super chill. And yet when it came to pronouncing Don Quixote, she was absolutely adamant that it was a pretentious affectation to start Don Quixote. I like, who talks like that outside Spain? Don Quixote. And as soon as you accept the absurdity of saying Don Quixote, then you have to sort of accept the absurdity of saying Ajax or Valencia, as opposed to pronouncing it in the anglicized version as a, an exponent of an anglicized language. I don't know. She might have been wrong. She wasn't wrong about anything else, including my A-level prospects as it goes. But I just always think of her when I get picked up on things like pronunciation. When you say, no, you must pronounce it like they do, as opposed to, like you would, reading your own language phonetically. But don't start talking to me about Beecham Square and the Chumley Warners. I fully accept that there are lots of words in English that if you were to read them phonetically, you'd be blackballed from your local club and ostracised from polite society for being a bit of an oik. Does anyone know what I'm talking about? I hope so. I sometimes feel that I go off on tangents that are a little bit too digressional. But not today, because that's relevant, isn't it? Because that's the call I haven't had yet. Why is it not relevant that Ajax fans were banned from Stamford Bridge in November of 2019, or that two European, continental European clubs had matches where the away fans were banned? And of course, the... I mean, that's also true. The head of FIFA was at the signing of the peace deal last week. I still don't really know why. But I just don't know why. But the idea that politics and football don't mix is obviously a position that nobody believes, but which idiots and liars adopt whenever Gary Lineker expresses a political opinion. Oh, forgive me. I believe the mantle has now been passed to Gary Neville. How dare he have a political opinion, say the people who passionately believe in free speech. As long as it's free speech they agree with. Josh is in Birmingham. Josh, what do you reckon?
Yeah, hi, James. Thanks for taking the call. First-time caller. I'm slightly nervous about this, but...
it's only me. I'm a
Villa fan. I'm from Birmingham, and I often listen to the radio and get outraged with what I hear. I feel like I should pull my arm up just to beat the radio, just so I've got something to beat the radio with. But it just so happens today I'm off work and I've got a bit of a cold.
But I'm delighted that we have your company.
Thank you. Well, what I would like to say is that I think the word of the day today has to be hypocrisy, doesn't it? It has to be. This faux outrage at the fans of Maccabi Tel Aviv being banned from visiting Birmingham, even though that decision was made in the interest of public safety. As you said, there's a precedent for that with Ajax or yes. Ajax, whatever you want to call it. And the problem is that that same faux outrage is coming from the same commentators, sadly, James, including yourself, including representatives of the UK media and various political leaders who were cheerleading the banning of Russian athletes from world sports events. Now, I supported that at the time as well. I think that there was a clear justification. I listened to your analysis on it and it made sense to me. But it's hypocrisy, isn't it, to say that this amounts to anti-Semitism.
Well, I don't know. Do you know what I have to do now? I have to make sure that I'm not being unduly defensive, because you have you've criticised me, and I have to. This is one of the things that I'm constantly working on, Josh. In a lifelong wish to become a better person. I want to make sure that I'm not being unduly defensive, which is why I'm babbling a bit, to give myself a little bit of space to get my thoughts in order. And I think, whether we like it or not, the status of Russia in the context of the illegal invasion of Ukraine is not regarded by the government of our country as being on the same page as the actions of Israel in Gaza. Now, you may well think that it should be, but it is not. So the allegation of hypocrisy, I think, exists only in a theoretical rather than a legislative or political universe. And in a theoretical universe, you can make it land, but you can't compare apples with pears.
Yeah, well, I mean, to some extent, I can accept that. But is it not the job of the media?
Israel is a close ally of the United Kingdom, whether you like it or not. Russia is an obvious enemy.
Yeah, but the media, therefore. So, fine, if we've got political leaders who are taking that stance, then fine. But is it not the job of the media to expose the hypocrisy?
I'm letting you. I'm letting you allege it, and I'm pushing back, and that's why I'm worried that I might be being personally defensive, because you went and included me in your critique. If only you'd just left it to everybody else, I could have. No, I'm joking, because I do resist what you're saying. You cannot put Russia and Israel in the same boat. It may be. It's unlikely, but it may be that 2, 3, 4 years hence, when full inquiries and investigations are complete and the International Criminal Court has done its best or done its worst, it may well be that you can make that comparison, but you can't make it now. So the allegation of hypocrisy doesn't land in the way that you think it does.
You got a bit off piste as well, mate. Well, let me just park that for a moment then.
Okay.
Just pick up, as we're in a phase of humility right now, right? And it seems that I've started off with a critique of you, and it's a nice conversation so far. So can I just pick up on a couple of other things that you've mentioned?
Okay.
But for me, there seems to be a form of conflation of anti-Semitism with the critique of Israel here again, in some of the things that you've said in some of the calls that have been taken already. The notion that there will be Jewish people who are not welcome, or people will not be welcome because they are Jewish when this match takes place. It's for the birds, frankly. There will be Jewish people at the Villa Ground when this match takes place on the night of the game who are draped in the Palestine flags, and they will be denouncing the state of Israel for committing genocide in Gaza.
And there'll be Jewish people draped in no flags at all cheering for Aston Villa. But if there are attacks on Maccabi fans driven by anger at what's gone on in Gaza, none of the people engaging in that violence, whether it's physical or verbal, are going to pause to ask each individual supporter whether or not they approve of the actions of the IDF in Gaza or not.
So you can criticise Israel
without being anti-Semitic, however hard some people work to pretend otherwise, but if you're attacking fans of an Israeli football club for being fans of an Israeli football club, you're coming perilously close, or probably wading headfirst into actual anti-Semitism, because you're attacking them because they're Jewish.
There's a couple of things here. First is because we want to make a stance against the legitimacy of Israel. And they do that through sporting events. So there's an approach there to oppose that. The second point, though,
yes,
is that Maccabi Tel Aviv are one of the most offensive fan bases in the world, who are very much pro-Israeli and pro-Israeli genocide. And we've seen some of the stances that they're taking in other countries in order to target any pro-Palestinian voices. You know, I think it's not purely the fact that those people have been targeted because they are from Israel, or because they, and certainly not because they are Jewish.
No, but you have evidence from Amsterdam, from the Ajax game, the Ajax game, of WhatsApp groups arranging something that the contributors to the group called Hunt the Jews, because Maccabi were coming to town. So, I mean, you can have of course you can. The argument about where the line is between anti-Israeli sentiment and anti-Semitism, but I'm afraid Hunt the Jews is clearly on one side of that line, and it was a direct experience and contributor to the violence that we saw in Amsterdam when they played Ajax.
Absolutely, and absolutely disgusting. Yeah. You know, the fact that that took place is absolutely disgusting. I am.
And if
am
the, if Birmingham's decision,
I was just going to say, I'm a Villa supporter. I live in Birmingham. I am also very much involved in pro-Palestinian causes, and I can tell you that there's no such WhatsApps taking place here, and there's no conflation being had. I stand shoulder to shoulder with many Jewish people who are against the apartheid state of Israel, who are against the genocide of Israel, who are against the occupation of Palestine, many Jewish people. And so there's no conflation here between Judaism.
No, but you don't know. You don't know that there is. I get racist or Islamophobic texts saying, oh yeah, but the Muslims will attack the Israeli fans, which is an appalling conflation of people who will be engaging in anti-Semitism with all Muslims. But that doesn't seem to garner anything like the outrage or the protest that some of the other conflations correctly and rightly garner. So you don't know what is going on in other WhatsApp groups or outside of your own world. You can't say with absolute certainty that there is not violence planned. And we have to presume that the police think that there is, or at least that it's highly likely, whether they've got intelligence or not. So I don't actually know. I think I know. I mean, you approve of the decision of banning the away fans, don't you? I just need to clarify that before we say goodbye.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the interest of public safety, it makes sense. Yeah. I approve further, though, of the decision for the team not to be able to play in this country at all, but that's a different stance.
It is, and we haven't even mentioned the Eurovision Song Contest.
Well, don't get me started.
thank you, Josh. Have a great weekend. We didn't get there. Maybe because there isn't a destination. This idea of what Josh said and what a lot of people a thinking, which is that it is solely about public safety. Keir Starmer clearly believes that it isn't. It is about anti-Semitism. And yet, making that case intellectually is a little bit more difficult than perhaps some of the people making it rhetorically allow or realise. I don't know, I could be wrong. Do you want to know the results of that poll? I mean, how many people are following closely or not even aware? What do you think? I'll tell you after this.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner has called for an immediate review of a ban on Israeli fans at an Aston Villa match. Maccabi Tel Aviv supporters have been told they can't attend next month's Europa League tie because of safety concerns. Ministers and officials are holding talks that could see that decision reversed. The digital minister, Ian Murray, has told LBC that discussions with appropriate authorities will take place today.
The Prime Minister and most politicians have been very, very clear about that. We should not be, as a country, determining whether or not you can go to public events based on your race, religion or nationality, and we're in a very dark space if we end up in that position.
So it should be reversed?
I think it's the wrong decision. Government doesn't get involved in the operational decisions of the police, but we've made our views very clear in terms of how we think this is the wrong decision that's been made.
West Midlands Police, which backed the move, had cited current intelligence and previous incidents for the decision. Ofcom has sanctioned the BBC over a Gaza documentary that broke broadcasting rules. It failed to declare the programme was narrated by the son of a Hamas official. The regulator says it was a serious breach and has ordered the BBC to broadcast a prime-time statement about its conclusions. President Zelensky will make the case for US-supplied long-range weapons when he meets Donald Trump later. The two leaders are due to discuss the war in Ukraine at the White House. Kira Rudik is a Ukrainian MP.
We really hope that President Trump, being so happy about resolving situation in the Middle East, will finally start applying pressure on Russia.
Mr. Trump has agreed to meet his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, in Hungary in the coming weeks. Three far-right extremists are being sentenced for planning an escalating terror campaign. Christopher Ringrose, Marco Pizzetu and Brogan Stewart were found guilty in May of planning attacks on mosques and synagogues. Stock markets across Europe have tumbled this morning following sharp falls in the US. There are growing concerns about millions of dollars of bad loans and alleged fraud at American regional banks. Analysts are also nervous about the risks of an AI bubble. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was down 134 points. That's 1.4% at 93.01. The pound buys $1.34 and a euro 14. LBC weather, cloudy again today with patchy light rains, some sunny spells possible in the south and west, a high of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 4 minutes after 11, and I think Sarah speaks for many of you when she writes, "I love you, James, but your hook and teases drive me up the blooming wall." How do you think I feel about them? I try and conjure up a little bit of tension during the programme by telling you that I'll reveal something a little later, and then I completely forget. I get castigated for it all the way home. But I'll do this one first, and then we'll get stuck into something completely different. And then in the next hour of the programme, we'll get stuck into something even more completely different. So I did, yesterday's show. It's a collector's item. I don't think we'll ever do it again. I can't think of circumstances in which a story is going to be dominating the news agenda so completely, and I'm going to sit here feeling cocky enough to say nobody cares. Nobody cares. Nobody knows what's going on, and even if they did, they don't care. And it's a weird thing to do, because obviously when you're looking at the front page of the Times, the Daily Telegraph, the Guardian, the Daily Mail, the Daily Express, probably not the Daily Star, but I wouldn't have been surprised, actually. And you're sitting here with your little radio show, and you're going, nah, they've all got it wrong. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. Of course, I understand the difference between public interest and what the public is interested in. But after PMQs, I didn't even think this was particularly public interest. So I'm sitting here with extraordinary arrogance. What do you mean, as usual? And I'm thinking, nobody cares. And we did the show on that premise. So we did a phone-in yesterday, and of course you can use Global Player or the LBC app to rewind live radio and check for yourself. We did a phone-in yesterday, and I don't think we'll ever do it again, on the premise that this is no subject for a phone-in. Ring me and prove it. Or, of course, the thing that was really quite perilous was the corollary of ring me and prove it, which was don't ring me and prove it. So this is not a subject that people have anything interesting to say about. Don't ring me and prove it. Happily, some people did ring me and also prove it, but it was the anti-topic, if you like. And today, a colleague handed me some research, which could have been filed under, oh my God, could James have been more right? Because what it says is this. How closely, if at all, have you followed the collapse of the case of two people accused of spying in the UK for China? By far the largest constituency, 33% of respondents replied, I am not aware of the story. I'm not even aware of the story, which is a slightly damning indictment of the British population's relationship with the news, but nonetheless, a significant vindication of the position that we adopted yesterday. The second biggest constituency of respondents to the question, how closely, if at all, have you followed the collapse of the case of two people accused of spying in the UK for China? The second biggest constituency, coming in at 27%, I am aware of the story, but I'm not following it. So a whopping 60% of respondents demonstrably not interested or not aware in the story. the third biggest constituency of respondents to the question, how closely, if at all, have you followed the collapse of the case of two people accused of spying in the UK for China? The third biggest constituency at 26%. Not very closely. So that is an extraordinary 86% of respondents who are either unaware of the story, not following the story, or not following the story very closely. And then, of course, you have to remember people lie. If I say to you, are you aware of the story? Then if you're a little bit, conscious of wanting to appear clued up and well-informed, you might say, oh, absolutely, yes. So it could be that these figures are even more skewed towards not interested or not aware. At 11%, you've got fairly closely, which means if you've been doing your mental arithmetic as we've been going along, you should be able to tell me how many people replied very closely when asked how closely, if at all, they have been following the collapse of the case of two people accused of spying in the UK for China. 3% of respondents have been following the story very closely, and yet, for much of this week, you could have been forgiven for thinking that it was the only story in town. Now, if people should care more, that's on us. Well, not just me, but everyone else, actually. Everyone who's been giving it loads and loads of attention have clearly failed appallingly in their duty to the public to make them care about the things that they should care about. Or it was never that big deal at all. Or something in between. But I just thought those figures were fascinating, didn't you? Absolutely fascinating. 3%, which is a very roundabout way of saying, no wonder the phones didn't ring until about 20 to 11 yesterday morning. In 9 minutes, just as I predicted they would. But no, the faces on some of my colleagues suggest that I probably shouldn't be doing that again, proving that my analysis of a story is correct by garnering precisely no phone calls to the programme with anything interesting to say. I'm always reminded at these moments of the time I nearly did a phone-in about what it's like not to have a phone. You think I exaggerate? I read a story about people who don't have a phone. It was about 15%, no, it wouldn't have been that high. And I got halfway through asking you to give me a ring if you haven't got a phone. Can you see what the flaw in that plan would have been? Give me a ring now if you haven't got a phone. 0345 6060973. 3%, yeah. So, complete change of pace now. And I can't quite believe that we're going to have this conversation, because when I started doing this job, not long after I started doing this job, I became a father for the first time. I became a father. I became a parent. And it meant that my interest in parenting issues was acute. I was drawn towards the story today of the poor young woman who wanted a home birth, but sadly it ended in tragedy. But I still find stories like that a little bit too hard to contemplate, and I certainly wouldn't do now what I might have done once, which is use them as a springboard into a sort of castigation of women who choose to go down those paths. I just find it all so fraught. But we've had those conversations before, and we've had lots and lots of conversations about how hard it is for women to have it all. These slightly unhelpful contributors to public discourse who work in the city on seven-figure salaries and also manage to have 17 children, raised largely by nannies and private school teachers, but nonetheless they are apparently proof that you can have it all. And then sometimes 10 years later they write a book that gets serialised in the Daily Mail saying, I was so wrong, I discovered I couldn't have it all when I found my husband bonking the au pair, or something like that. And it just goes round again and again and again. But we've never done it from a man's point of view. And this is generationally fascinating to me, because one of the interesting things about having done this job, having had the privilege of spending my mornings with you for so long now, is that I have seen generational change. I have tracked it. I hope that I have managed to change with it, rather than being one of those radio presenters who's punting out the same opinions that he had in 2000, in 2025. I really don't want to be that guy. And if you think I am that guy, you must tell me, politely, and possibly privately. But the conversation about how hard it was to go back to work, or to juggle maternity leave, parental leave, with the job was huge 20 years ago. And I don't know how much better things have got, to be honest with you, because once you move out of that zone, your interest in it inevitably diminishes. But there's some research published now that comes at it from the man's point of view, which I'm slightly taken aback by. And that's what I mean by generational change. So I was so, so lucky that I had this job when I became a dad, because I clocked off. In fact, no, I clocked off at 1 o'clock. I clocked off at 1 o'clock. I still do most days. And it meant that I was regularly at the school gates to pick my daughters up. I was regularly able to go trick-or-treating with them, or to get involved in homework and all those sort of things. I don't think I really pulled my weight, if we were to break down the division of labour fairly and objectively, but I did a heck of a lot more than I could or would have done if I was getting in at 7, 8 o'clock in the evening, knackered and desperate for a gin and tonic and a cigar. And that was lucky. I was lucky. But if I'd had a normal job, it would not have been the case 20 years ago when I became a father, that any employer would have taken seriously my desire to do some parenting. All the conversations we've had in the past have been about employers not letting mums be parents, or employers being unhelpful to mums being parents. This is a tricky one, this, because I don't know if you're going to want to ring me. There's a great piece by Gabby Hinsliff in The Guardian today addressing some research by a charity called Working Families, which has found that 3/4 of dads now say they genuinely want to share the parenting load equally with their partners, but that their employers don't let them. And those are the stories that I want. Okay? I want you to tell me what happened, why you haven't been, and also, and I hope I can get this right, I want you to tell me how it makes you feel. So my generation was probably the last that was raised in circumstances where it was all mum. Childcare was all mum for my generation. And with each passing year, the situation began to shift to the point where, when I became a parent, the presumption was still, for example, that mum would give up work for either for maternity leave, or if you were in a strong enough position financially, for much longer. There were a few exceptions in our circle. Sometimes the mum was earning considerably more than the dad, so dad was the one that gave up work and stayed at home. A vanishingly small number of people. Very, very, very little paternity leave. When I was becoming a parent, I think I took 2 weeks off, and they paid me, actually, which they weren't even required to do. It was very decent of them. And it was quite rare for any of my peer group, any of my fellow dads, to be getting anywhere close to doing equal childcare with their wives. And the reason I mention generations is because I don't think we really felt that we wanted to. We might have wanted to intellectually. We might have claimed to our wives or our partners that we wanted to, but it didn't. Society was not a place where it felt normal for 3/4 of men to say that they want to be doing equal parenting. That's 20 years ago. Argue with me if you want, but I promise you that was the society I was pretty sure that I lived in. Now you've got 1 in 5 men saying that when they've requested time off work for family reasons, their question, the employer will say, where's your wife? Or where's your girlfriend? Where's your partner? Translation, as Gabby Hinsliff points out in the paper today, isn't that her job? And perhaps, sotto voce, if in your house it's not her job, then what kind of man does that make you? So is it still the case in the workplace that a dad who wants to be a dad is looked at a little bit suspiciously? I want you to tell me about two things. I want the facts and I want the feelings. So the stories, the experiences you have that fit into the category of employers not really recognizing your parenting rights and duties, somehow thinking, well, I can't say that I've got to go. I need a day off for sports day. Or my daughter's been taken ill and my wife's busy. I've got to go. I'm going to have to go to the school and pick up. Just the way that is not in any. And I'm not, I'm not one of those weirdos who claims that life is much easier for women than it is for men in our society. But on this issue, oddly, I think that the experience for women has got better. It's still far from perfect. And I have never, to my mild embarrassment, and largely because of my age, I've never thought before about what it's like for men. I'm delighted to read that three quarters of men want to be doing an equal share of parenting. And I'm also here to tell you it's brilliant. You'll never do anything quite as rewarding or as satisfying in your, or as fun sometimes in your life. Equally, it can be hideously monotonous and incredibly frustrating and a right old bore. But, you know, that's life. You want to do it, but your employer sort of won't let you. I want you to tell me what that's like, okay? 0345 606 0973. But I also want to know about how it feels. So you don't, a lot of us grew up not really knowing that there was an option. You know, my dad was a newspaper journalist, and that involved a lot of work and a lot of work away from home. And it was never really questioned at all. It never crossed my mind that Dad might have wanted to spend more time with me and my sister than he could. And at weekends, quite often, he'd be doing a shift for the Sunday Telegraph, so he'd be working all day Saturday. We'd go to church on Sunday, have Sunday lunch. Very, very, you know, didn't have kickabouts in the garden like some of my mates' dads did. We did, but it felt like a special occasion in my house, because Dad was always so busy, always working so hard. Got one of those men, generationally, Yorkshire, whole combination of factors, defined himself by his work. And it never occurred to me that he was losing out on something. It never occurred to me that he was, what's the word that I want? He was sacrificing something in order to be the provider. That's the way that the family dynamic broke down in those days. And it has diminished, hasn't it, that dynamic, with every passing year, every passing decade. So you fast forward from the early 70s to the early noughties when I became a dad, and it had broken down a lot. And what I mean by generational change is that when you go from the early noughties to now, another 20 years or so, it's broken down even more. At home, that feeling, but what's it like at work? So you wanted to be different from your dad. You wanted to do more. You wanted to be at home more. No criticism of your dad, but actually 21st century Britain won't let you. What's that like? So I want the stories, but I also want the feelings. And do you know what I'm thinking of? Because there's another article today about mental health support for new dads. Something else that's completely overlooked. We know about one in five women developing a mental illness during pregnancy or in the first year after birth. But dads can also fall through the cracks in this conversation. It's another piece, a separate piece, published recently in September. And I just wonder, before we go to the break, how many people checked up on someone yesterday? And we opened the show by reflecting upon the news that Ricky Hatton, the boxer, had taken his own life. And just sort of just encouraged each other, didn't we, to just check up on someone. I checked up on the person I was intending to check up on, but I checked up a bit late. And he knew I was talking about him, which was simultaneously quite awkward and quite poignant. When I said, I think I know who I'm going to check up on later. He knew I was talking about him. Just looking at this, the difficulties of being a dad on that level, but more obviously, the difficulties of being a dad who wants to do more parenting, but can't. Okay? Hit the numbers now. You will get through. 0345 606 0973 is the number that you need. What's it like to want to be to do more parenting as a dad, but you're workplace, your employer won't let you? I want the stories, and I want the reactions, the emotions, the feelings. It's 11:21.
This is LBC. Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m.
I have found completely shocking
the extent of the anti-Semitism
that people have felt because of what's been going on in the Middle East, emboldened not just to criticise the Israeli government, but to use what is happening in the Middle East as a way of allowing you to expose what you really believe. And I think a lot of people have shown themselves for what they really are.
Tom Swarbrick with cybersecurity from BT. Security solutions built for businesses. LBC.
At Aldi, we're delighted to tell you that we've come out on top again! Yes, we've won which cheapest supermarket for September, beating our competitors, even with their loyalty card prices. Just goes to show, you're on to a winner when you shop at Aldi! Visit aldi.co.uk/awards for more.
You know, sometimes you just want to mosey. Travel your own world. Slow things down a mite. meet the locals, and smell the coffee. So friends, take time to sit down with the folks at Little America and let them tailor-make your trip to Canada and the U.S. just the way you like it. For slow travel that nourishes the soul, head to littleamerica.co.uk.
Our pets in a pickle. We're here when it matters most. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
11:23 is the time, and that's when I most need your help, really, isn't it? When things are changing in our society, but I'm no longer in the sort of hot spot. I'm no longer in the hit zone. And we're talking about dads who want to do more dadding, but currently can't. Or can, of course. I mean, positive stories always welcome on this programme as well, although it doesn't always feel like that. You want to do more dadding. You want to be more present for your children than perhaps your dad was, because of circumstances beyond his control. But society hasn't really caught up with that social change yet. What happens at work, and crucially, of course, how does it feel? 0345 6060 973 is the number that you need. I'd like also to look at postnatal depression for men. Paternal postnatal depression is a thing, but I don't know. That might be a bit too tricky for you to talk about. If you want to talk about it, perhaps we'll move on to it a little later in the hour. Tom's in Weston-super-Mare. Tom, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. It's nice to talk to you. I've been a long-time listener, so this is exciting.
Tempted you onto the programme, finally. What would you like to say?
So I'm a dad. I'm 37. I'm a software engineer. So last year, me and my wife started having marital problems. You know, we've been together for like 15 years. I was getting very stressed. My mental health was taking a dive. So I actually went to the doctor, and he recommended I reduce my working hours. So I went to my workplace and asked to reduce my hours from 37 to 32. And that was like, the reason I gave was I need to help my wife a bit more. I need to pick up my son from school because I've got a six-year-old little boy with send needs because we're all a bit neurodivergent in our house.
Sure.
They refused. So they flat refused. And my marriage ended up breaking down. And we're now getting divorced. Not living there anymore. Yeah, it's been a rough year.
It certainly has, Tom. It certainly has. It will sound a bit glib. Things will get better. I'd really hope they will. Yeah. But tell me, what did they say? What did the employer say when you said that that's why you wanted the time off? What did they give you a reason? Did they say that's just not feasible? We wouldn't be able to keep the business afloat if you took two afternoons off a week.
No, well, this is the thing. It was a big old company. I was only, asking to go down to 32 hours. So it was like, they said it was a business need. They said it wasn't fitting with a business need, that they'd have to rejig the schedule, which seemed like a really, poor reason to me. I don't think it was justified. I think it would have affected the business. The effect would have been negligible.
You're not a very good manager if you can't absorb that kind of tweak to one employee's hours. I would suggest.
Exactly. I would suggest that too. And so I thought it was pretty reasonable. I was being really upfront about my capacity for work as well. As a neurodivergent person, I was saying 30-40 hours in front of a computer every week is not healthy for anyone.
No, that's very true.
And beyond 32 hours, there's diminishing returns for me. And I was really suffering from burnout.
It would have been in their interest as well, and it would have been good for the family, good for you, and arguably even good for them, because they'd have had a more engaged and a more enthusiastic employee. So what did you do? Did you leave the job because you couldn't get that, or did you soldier on?
I ended up having a full-on mental breakdown, James. But No, it's okay. Things are getting much better now. I'm very happy now. I think it did need to happen, but it was very explosive at the time.
I'm sure.
And I did leave that job. It ended up going a bit down the old ACAS tribunal route, but I can't talk much about that.
No, that's fine, and I wouldn't want you to. But in the meantime, your wife felt that she was doing everything at home and you were doing nothing or doing not enough. And you wanted to do more, but in many ways, you're the perfect example of what we're talking about. You wanted to do more, but society or your employer just wouldn't let you. And if they had, who knows where we'd be today.
We're both working full-time. We're both two adults in our 30s working full-time with not much help from family for childcare. And I think this is a thing that people don't talk about in society enough. The government are always talking about like getting people back into work, yeah. But like nowadays, like if you don't have help from family and your two parents are both working, how are you supposed to manage that?
Really good question. And they offer, I mean, they've done the tweaking to the free childcare, but it's still suboptimal. It hasn't landed, and it doesn't help people whose children are at school and need picking up at 3:30 when you don't clock off work until 5:30. Take care, Tom, won't you, mate? Seriously.
Oh, can I just say one more thing?
Of course, I just want to
say one more thing, because now I'm actually out of work right now. I've been trying to do some freelance work over the summer, yeah. But I'm trying to find full-time employment again, and I'm finding that it's really hard because I'm being very honest with every interview I have. I turn up and say, look, I need to finish at 2:30 on Thursdays and Fridays so I can pick up my son. Obviously, I'm not seeing him much now because we live separately. And I had to actually walk out of a job interview on Tuesday at a college, which I thought would be really, well, for a start, they were disability confident. I thought they'd be inclusive, and it says all over their website they're very flexible. But when I said I needed to do that, they just said, oh, we're not going to be able to facilitate that.
And that's it, isn't it? It's, you can put all the flipping warm words on your website that you want, but actually when push comes to shove, employers need to be accommodating men like you, dads like you. They probably do more for mums than they used to do, and I'm not in any way setting up any kind of culture war there, but the idea that dads could get that kind of accommodation, it's still suboptimal for mums, don't get me wrong, but for dads, it feels very different, and I'm so sorry that you're at the coalface of this, that you're at the really sharp end of this, because it's why this article by Gabby Hinsliff, who's one of the best writers in the business in this country at the moment, is so effective because she gives it the sotto voce. And I don't think you experienced this. I hope you didn't. But the idea that if you're asking for time off, to look after the children, it's just not very manly. That's the subtext that you'd hear sometimes in these kind of spaces. Tom, take care. It is 29 minutes after 11. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Sometimes I get the question right immediately. Sometimes I need to speak to someone first before I can just sort of hone it a little better. I think we're there. You want to do more dadding, but you can't. Why not? And what's that like? 0345 6060 973 is the number you need. Thomas Watts is here now with your headlines.
West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner has called for an immediate review of a ban on Israeli fans at an Aston Villa match. Maccabi Tel Aviv supporters have been told they can't attend next month's Europa League tie because of safety concerns. Ofcom has sanctioned the BBC for breaching broadcasting rules in its Gaza, How to Survive a War Zone documentary. It says a failure to declare the narrator's links to Hamas was materially misleading. President Zelensky will make the case for US-supplied long-range missiles when he meets Donald Trump later. The two leaders are due to discuss the war in Ukraine at the White House. LBC weather, cloudy with patchy light rain for many. Some sunny spells possible in the south and west. A high of 17 degrees.
LBC. You have 30 seconds to defuse a bomb. But it isn't any bomb. It's a chemical weapon filled with poisonous gas planted by a serial killer. You need quiet. But your ears never stop ringing. You haven't slept properly in months.
Oh, God.
You're on the edge. And you've only got 3 seconds left.
Lana!
Trigger Point. Returns October 26 on ITV1 and ITVX. Hold your breath.
I'm telling you, raise taxes. That's how.
Cut spending. Less waste. More sense.
Move north. Get more for your money.
Until winter hits your heating bill.
Fair.
Up to 9.13% annual return. We all agree that's strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to ignore.
Cufflink. Auto-invest property-backed from £500. Visit cufflink.com. That's K-U-F-L-I-N-K. Register your interest today. Your capital is at risk. Tax rules apply to IF ISAs and may be subject to change. Cufflink is authorised and regulated by the FCA.
At TfL, we're helping to make bus journeys greener. Our entire bus fleet is 100% low or zero emission at the tailpipe, including those for our Superloop routes, helping improve air quality for all. And we'll have a fully zero-emission fleet by 2034. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with.
From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 11:32 and you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I don't know if we ever coined a phrase for it, did we? Denmarkitis would have probably been the lazy one we came up with. But quite often when we turn our attention to topics like this one, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about how hard it is for dads. Again, this writer puts it so brilliantly. Dad's caught in a struggle that mums know so well. When you want your employer to help you do more dadding, be more available as a parent, you want to strike a little bit more of a balance than you did before you became a parent between parenting and working. You want to remain a committed and enthusiastic employee, but you need to do the school run twice a week, or you sometimes might need a little bit of time off, which you're happy to make up maybe in order to attend to family matters. And your employer just doesn't speak that language. I think the next caller has an employer who does, so there is light at the end of the tunnel. But that's the best way to phrase it, is dads discovering what mums have always known. Because as more and more of us, dads, recognise not only that we want to be, we want to do more parenting, we want to be more present for our children, but also that we should be, because the likelihood of our partner working, our wife working now, is a million times higher than it was when we were children, or when I'm just conscious of my age, when your grandparents were in the zone. The world hasn't changed enough. This is one of the things that interests me most about the conversations we have, is that our lives have changed, but the society in which we live those lives have not. So growing up when mum was doing almost all of the parenting and dad was doing almost all of the working, normal in the 70s, less so in the 80s, even less so in the 90s, by the noughties, not the given at all. Much more likely that both parents would be going out to work. Much, much more likely. And even if you were lucky enough to be able to afford to take a year or two off, you were still going to have to go back to work as soon as the little one started primary school, for the massive majority of people. And everywhere, from childcare to schooling, school finishing times, school days, society is still in many ways rooted in a world where mum was staying at home to look after the children and dad was going to work. So our lives have changed beyond recognition compared to previous generations, but the society in which we live those lives is still largely the same. And that's why I have not noticed the difficulties dads will have trying to change, because I'm not a dad in that zone anymore. I don't have children of the right age. I don't know what it would be like to have a full-time job and a full-time child, a full-time family, and to be asking my employer to reflect the changes that we have made in our lives, but which our relationship with our employer or with society have not yet acknowledged. What does the future look like? And the reason I mentioned Denmark is because it probably looks a bit like Denmark. And this is one of those areas where I don't have to rely entirely upon your contributions. Patrick writes, in Denmark, equal share is the norm. Men not taking 3 months for parenting would be frowned upon. I had 6 months paid parental leave and I gifted 3 months to my wife. And the reason I say I know a little bit about this is because we did a thing. I've mentioned this to you before. We went to live in Denmark for a week. And my wife wrote an article about the differences between being a mum of children in Denmark, in Copenhagen, wonderful, wonderful Copenhagen, and the Danish people that we swapped lives with came here and wrote an article about it as well. And it was pretty chalk and cheesy, I have to tell you, or even cheese and chalky. And it makes a mockery of those right-wing arguments. Oh, you can't do this. You don't know what it's like running a business. Oh, you couldn't possibly do that. It's like the minimum wage. Oh, we can't afford to pay people minimum wage. That's absolutely ridiculous. We'll all go bust. I've only got 8 Porsches in the company garage. You can do it. Scandinavian countries are often way ahead of the curve on this stuff. And if they can do it, why can't we? We're Northern European. We don't have siestas. We've got more in common than sets us apart. And in fact, let's add that to the list. Why can't we? Why is the UK employer not more minded to looking after their staff in a way that a Danish or a Swedish employer demonstrably is? Dan's in Reading. Dan, what would you like to say?
Good morning, James. I have two kids. One, a 5-year-old son and a 2-year-old daughter, and my employer is one of the good ones, I suppose.
I'm going to try and sort your phone light out, Dan. It sounds like you're down a well. I hope you're not down a well, because if you are, I'll send help. Chris is in Worcester. Chris, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Hello, Chris. Basically, in my situation, I've had to leave my job as a teacher to be able to take part. It's a shame. My wife and I were living in London. We're both working. I was offered 2 weeks statutory, which is almost unpaid at this point. Then it was that, and I said I'd like some more time to help with my wife. You know, she had to have an emergency C-section. They said it's leave fully or that's it. So I didn't. I persevered in the job, but my wife was finding it quite hard. When her maternity pay ended, she needed a break, and I approached work again, and they said no. So I had to quit my job. And we couldn't live off one salary in London, so we've had to move to Worcester, which is lovely.
I know Worcester very well. It is lovely, but it's an extraordinary transformation of your existence based upon the fact that you need, well, either you wanted or you needed, or a combination of both, to do more dadding, to do more parenting.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I wouldn't trade it for the world. He's 18 months now and he's amazing. And I love being a part of his life. But
are you working now?
No, I've now got this problem where I'm trying to apply for the 33 hours, but it's a chicken and the egg. They want you to prove your income before you can get it. And to start work as a teacher, the way it would work out of the September cycle would be to start temping. And that's a 0 hours contract. And I can't guarantee the work. So we're only just making it by. We've got about £25 spare at the end of the week.
Oh, lordy. So your wife's working?
She's working. She's found a job with a school online, which is remarkable and makes her a bit more available.
Yes, but this is a perfect example of the world having changed, the way we live our lives having changed, and yet the society in which we live them being rooted in 20 or 30-year-old practices. And you'd have thought that education, perhaps naively, you'd have thought that education would be a sector in which some of these lessons were a little bit more self-evident than they are in others.
Well, as I said to your producer, I've found in my career that often, and not always, you know, schools have been very accommodating to female staff. You know, they've been able to come back on part-time contracts after maternity. I wouldn't go as far as saying it was discrimination, but I felt like the door was very much shut in my face
I would forgive you if you did go that far. The problem with alleging discrimination is that it always sounds as if you've got a beef with the people on the better end of the deal, and obviously you haven't, and I wouldn't either. But it's why this headline is so powerful. Millennial dads are caught in a struggle mums know so well. And for mums, some of that struggle has been successfully overcome. But for dads, I mean, you're on square one, aren't you, generationally speaking? These are not conversations that dads have been routinely and regularly having with their employers. It must be really frustrating.
It's extraordinary, frustrating. Yeah. At the moment, I really would like to work at least part time, but I can't. We're just trying to figure that out now.
as the earlier caller said, if you haven't got family support with childcare and stuff, then the road ahead is even more restricted, even more. What do they say then? So, I mean, I forgive me if I'm being naive, but I'd have thought that teaching would lend itself to flexibility more than almost any other subject under the sun. That's probably going to get me pilloried, isn't it, by the teachers listening.
I mean, historically, I think it was, and I've worked with plenty of, you know, colleagues who've gone on maternity, and they've been extraordinarily flexible with them. But again, I would go as far as saying that maybe it's considered still that sort of sexist mentality that, you know, the woman does the caring, the man does the working. So
yes, I mean, it is still there. We might all have the right words on our websites and have the all the right sort of intentions, but when push comes to shove, it's the sotto voce that Gabby Hinsliff writes about today. If in your house it's not her job to do this stuff, what kind of man does that make you? You got the other stuff about whether or not, is it really that urgent, the family crisis, or the boss will think a bit less of you for asking. That is a conversation that was constant in our house 20 years ago, when my wife and all of her friends, high-powered, highly successful, mostly media professionals were suddenly relegated to the second or third division when they tried to go back to work after having children, or when they barely took any maternity leave at all but tried to juggle the jobs with the new demands of parenting. Why can't I just leave at 4 o'clock? I've always felt if you're running a brilliant business, you're going to get more out of someone in an hour who's really, really happy and engaged than you are in 2 hours of someone who's there not quite under duress, but under a cloud of despondency and dejection. I don't know. That's probably why I've never run a business. 11:42 is the time. Chris, take care and good luck. Dan, back to you in Reading. You're one of the lucky ones.
I suppose I am. So my employer doesn't really have a problem with me taking some time off to attend to my kids.
Why do you think that is? What do you think is different about your employer and all the other employers that we've heard about?
I think it's because me and my manager, my direct manager, we're sort of in the same age bracket.
Okay.
We've got the same as kids around the same age. So I think he understands it more.
Goes the other way sometimes. It can cut the other way sometimes. If I'm coping, you should bloody well cope as well.
Yeah, true. And that is different. And then again, I think because I'm a contractor, I don't have a specific contract. I don't get paid holiday or sick pay.
Oh, so you've got to be careful.
Yeah.
How important was it to you to have more time, to have a better relationship or a more present relationship with your children than perhaps previous generations do or did?
I mean, it was super important. It was 100% important because my dad, I didn't have any relationship. I mean, I had a relationship with my dad, but it was very strained.
Yes.
Because my dad moved from Kenya when I was about seven to 8 years old. And we didn't live together again until about 17.
He was working to support you and the family.
Of course, yeah. So he came here. He left us in Kenya. He came here, obviously, to support us and everything else. So I've made a conscious choice, a conscious decision in my head. Like, I have to be very actively involved in especially my son's life.
don't say that. Little girls are great.
I mean,
I know what you mean.
I've been accused of loving my daughter more than my son, but I think my son needs my attention more than probably.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, no, okay, I get that. Yeah, I mean, that's dadding, isn't it? It's a thing. I suppose, in a way, you're not quite as blessed as I thought you were when you first came on, because if you're going to take the time off, you're not going to get paid for it.
No, so that's
equally, they could still say no. You know, I need you here till 6 o'clock today. I suppose it's a sort of hinterland, whereas, actually, no, not really, because I think the fellow who was trying to get the days cut, the program developing, wasn't expecting to get paid if he didn't do it in the afternoons. It is 11:45. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I've got a sort of missed information for you next, which involves one of those pieces of journalism that turns everything, almost everything that you've seen elsewhere, on its head. And it's looking at a trap that we may have fallen in together. This notion of the country being particularly plagued by worklessness or the problem, if you perceive it as a problem, of people on benefits being bigger than it has been in previous years. It turns out that the reality may be rather different. You'll really want to hear this after this.
Sunday with Lewis Goodall.
Bridget Phillipson, Education Secretary. Do you think that the Gaza protest should continue to go ahead?
I do recognise why over many, many months people have taken part in protests, because they see appalling suffering. I would urge people just to reflect on the impact that protest can have. Just because you have the right to protest doesn't mean that you have to protest in all circumstances.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Stephen Gethins, who's SNP Foreign Affairs spokesperson, are you keen to have another endless conversation about independence? Because you're so afraid of your own domestic record after 17 years in office.
The Scottish government does not have the same powers as the UK government.
You've got the most powerful subnational parliament in Europe.
That's garbage. I'm sorry.
Sunday with Lewis Goodall. Sunday morning from 10 on LBC.
Stayshore. What is Stayshore? Stayshore is not just the UK's favourite travel insurance.
StaySure is the confidence that comes with knowing that you're covered by the company with more five-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other provider. A company that welcomes people of all ages with pre-existing medical conditions for single or multiple trips. So stay sure with StaySure Travel Insurance. UK's favourite relates to number of five-star Trustpilot reviews, T's and C's and verifications at staysure.co.uk/reviews.
Sharing intimate photos of her without her consent.
Unwanted touching. Unwanted comments. Unwanted nudes.
Controlling what she can and can't wear.
Controlling who she can and can't see.
Threatening her.
Enough. This is abuse.
If you think it's wrong, act on it.
Call it out, show support, report it.
There are many ways you can safely tackle violence against women and girls. Find out how at gov.uk/enough. If someone is in danger, call 999.
Your daily life often goes like this. With Air France, choose instead.
Wow.
Until the 21st of October, put your daily life on hold. Take advantage of Air France moments and book your flight to Beijing from £499, flying from London Heathrow via Paris. Return including tax. Elegance is a journey. Air France. To book and for terms and conditions, visit airfrance.co.uk.
I'm telling you, raise taxes, that's how.
Cut spending, less waste, more sense.
Move north, get more for your money.
Until winter hits your heating bill.
Fair.
Up to 9.13% annual return. We all agree that's strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to ignore.
Cufflink. Auto-invest property-backed from £500. Visit cufflink.com. That's K-U-F-L-I-N-K. Register your interest today. Your capital is at risk. Tax rules apply to IF ISAs and may be subject to change. Cufflink is authorised and regulated by the FCA.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
James O'Brien on LBC.
It's 11:49. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I'm just wondering whether or not that research, that polling on how much people cared, knew or were following the China spy story should have actually been filed under missed information. I'm not quite sure, actually, but it's too late now. And I use it as an introduction into my next guest because it highlights how susceptible we all are sometimes to falling into a sort of consensus, even if the consensus is false. Particularly, dare I say, if you're in the habit of listening to a certain type of phone in radio. Not, I hope, the type that I make, but you know the type I mean. The welfare, everyone's on welfare, nobody's working. We're in the midst of a spiralling situation, everything's terrible, people are swinging the lead, everybody's taking the mickey. The reason why my life's not going as well as I hope is because I know the woman over the road who's got 48 children and she's got a flat in Ibiza and she hasn't worked since 1963. You're familiar with the position I adopt, all of which is why I read a column in the Financial Times this week with increasingly goggled eyes. It is by Chris Giles, their economics commentator, and Chris joins me now. If we start with the headline, Chris, no need for a moral panic about the welfare system, and then follow with a question, why did you feel the need to write this article?
Well, because just pretty much as your intro suggested, there seems to be a consensus that there is a need for a moral panic, and everyone is on the fiddle or everyone is shirking in this country and it can't go on and it's never been like this. And frankly, most of that's nonsense.
Of course, you need to have the statistics and indeed the tools to access the statistics in place to establish that it is nonsense. So what should we know?
Well, I think there's two really important things that we should know. And one is that the amount that the UK spends on non-pensioner welfare, working age welfare, so that includes all forms of means-tested support, so universal credit, all that, all forms of disability, sickness payments, all the things that are absolutely going up rather fast at the moment, but it includes absolutely everything, has been basically constant for 40 years under Labour Conservative governments at about 4.5% of national income. It's not rising massively faster than we thought. And one of the reasons is there's a very long-standing situation in the UK where if you squeeze the welfare system in one way, claims pop up somewhere else. And that is quite likely to be going on at the moment. Another really important statistic is just, you know, how many people are working? What's the level of non-working people? And of course, here are some of the stats we have to be a bit cautious with because they're part of the stats that aren't going very well for the Office for National Statistics at the moment, but we're close to a record in our employment rate. It's really very, very high. It's much higher than at the best periods of the Thatcher government, the best periods of the Major government, the best periods of the Blair government. So it really improved in the 2010s a lot, and is really not much worse than that even after COVID. Now, you've got to be a little bit cautious with that, but I think if it's going wrong in one direction, it's probably underestimating the strength of employment, not overestimating it. Can't prove that. And then there's some really big numbers flying around, like 6.5 million people on out-of-work benefits, and this is 80% bigger than it was 2 or 3 years ago. Now, those are true figures from the Department of Work and Pensions, but only true because the Department of Work and Pensions is now counting the same stuff in a different way. So it's not showing anything real going on. It's just showing a different way of counting the same stuff. And that number is pretty, if you try and get, it's difficult, but if you try and get round all the different ways of counting, it's pretty much the same as it was in about 2014, 2015. So lots of ways, things haven't really changed very much.
So, yeah, big news. Nothing's changed. Except it is big news because it's so completely at odds with the prevailing narrative. There has been, to paraphrase, no explosion and there is no spiral.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no projection of a spiral. Now, of course, you want to look at why sickness and disability claims are rising so fast, because there's always going to be some fraud in the system, and any fraud makes the system illegitimate, and you really need to clamp down on that. Any government does. But you don't need to panic about it, and you need to look at what's going on quite carefully and decide whether, is it just because we're being really mean in one area, so people are sort of saying, well, okay, I'll try and get a disability instead of going through the normal channels, in which case you might want to look at how your welfare system is working overall, or make it more like make there be more conditions if you're having sickness elements to your welfare so that you still need to be looking for work. Those are totally reasonable things. It's also completely reasonable for government to say, we don't want to spend so much and tough for poor people.
Yes.
But that's not what people are saying. People are saying everyone's fiddling, everyone's shirking, and that's not true.
I know, exactly. It's a narrative of overgenerousness or of abuse. And, of course, as you conclude in your column, this is particularly timely because if Rachel Reeves, as expected, puts taxes up in November, then the kind of people who have been perhaps disseminating the prevailing narrative in our profession will be at great pains to argue that it's the welfare system that is responsible for the tax rises when it's anything but.
Yeah, and it's not something that's rising. There's two things that have got a lot more expensive, which, again, we need to think about. One is debt interest, so we're paying a lot more on government debt.
Yes.
Partly that's a global thing. Partly we have borrowed a lot over the last 5 years. We did have a pandemic, a once-in-100-year event. And the other thing is our health system is more expensive now, and that after COVID. And, you know, we do need to work on making more efficiencies in the NHS because we want, if we're spending this amount of money, we want it to be a better service.
Rhetorically crucial, though, isn't it? Because telling people that taxes are going up because your nan needs a new hip is very different from telling people that your taxes are going up because him over the
Ryan road. Ryan down the road is sponging.
Yes, exactly that. In fact, on that end, and you don't have to answer this, Chris, because it's a bit out of your immediate purview, but how frustrating do you find it as an economist when you see much of the journalism reflecting a reality that, at the very best, barely exists?
Well, I don't want to really comment on other journalism, but what I would say is that I think there's a real problem in the country where we try and pretend there are easy answers to difficult questions. And these are all about trade-offs, about, you know, nearly all public policies about trade-offs. How much should we tax people, to make poor people's lives better than they otherwise would be? Those are difficult questions. And there's not really a right or wrong, and you can take a very moralistic stance in many different ways on that.
Yeah.
But we should recognise it's not just there's one easy way, and anyone who thinks anything else or says it's difficult and complicated is wrong or lily-livered and can't, and or whatever, you know, and doesn't recognise there's a whole bunch of people who are sponging off the system.
At least one very unhappy Financial Times reader on the letters page today.
There was, yeah.
I'll let people discover that for themselves. Chris Charles, thank you very much indeed. Economics commentator at the FT, explaining the reality. We used to have a thing about moral panics on the programme. Do you remember? We used to spot them coming out of nowhere, like the kid in The Sixth Sense spotting dead people. But this is a huge one, and it's all part of the same story. Take a day off from blaming immigrants for everybody's problems and blame people on welfare instead, because you know what it's all about. Keeping the bad people rich and the poor people angry or frightened, or ideally both. Let's go back to the question about being a dad and how hard it is to be more of a dad than your dad was, because your employer still operates in a universe that is calibrated to your dad's generation and not yours. Nick's in Dudley. Has a nice West Midlands flavour to the show this week, and I'm here for it, Nick. What would you like to say?
No, thanks, James. I've actually got more of a positive story on this. I've got two children, 2 and 4, and my employer unofficially operates a don't take the mick policy, I think. So, for instance, my son's just started school. I was able to take an hour out the other day to go and attend a phonics workshop to learn how they do their phonics. The trade-off was I did some work later on the evening when they went to bed. To make the errors.
Yes.
So it's really helpful at home, though. My wife's a teacher, so although she gets a lot of holidays, she's also got a very inflexible job. She has to be there at a certain time. She has to be there until a certain time.
Same here, really, you see. Finally, so I feel seen. It's an absolute straitjacket, this gig.
the lack of flexibility with my wife's job, it would make it very difficult if mine weren't flexible. Now, having said that, my wife and I have sort of all-or-nothing days where it seems like one of us does all the childcare and the other one does none, just on what our work does. So the other day, I did all the childcare because my wife was at work, and then she had an open evening, which finished after the kids had gone to bed. So I did everything. Whereas yesterday, it was the other way around.
Swings and roundabouts. Perfect reflection.
Absolutely. And that's just the nature of it.
It's the new reality, and you're lucky enough that you can properly fit into it. And it actually reminds me about all of the people who had a fit of the vapours about the working from home increase, which makes perfect sense for a lot of people. Not for everybody, of course, but the idea that it was something that you had to be 100% behind or 100% against was absurd because of the differences it can make to lives like yours and families like yours. And I guess the biggest beneficiaries are the children.
Absolutely. And my dad worked shifts, so he'd do 2 days, 2 nights, 4 off. So some days he was there 4 days on the bounce.
Was he in Briley Hill?
I didn't see him. Or if I did, he was not in Briley Hill. He was in wonderful, sunny Oldbury.
Okay.
But again, it was all or nothing days. But it's the reality of the way it is now, I think, James. And I think employers are working out that if they want to get good people in, they have to be flexible with them or pay them megabucks. And you know what? It's probably easier to just say to somebody, work at home, and if you need to work an hour between 8 and 9 later to pick the kids up from school, that suits me better than paying you another $15,000 a year.
Beautifully put. I mean, I suppose you could have the flexibility in another $10,000 a year. That would be the best of both possible worlds. But hey-ho, let's not run before we can walk. And that was brilliant. I loved that hour because that little paradigm is one that we return to again and again, is our lives have changed. And I don't know what it's like because I'm not Nick's age. Or my children aren't his children's age, but our lives have clearly changed, and yet the society in which we're living those lives is not changing quickly enough. But a nice balance there between evidence that it's not changing quickly enough and proof that it is at least changing a bit. It's coming up to 12 noon. I have an enduring fascination with stories about people losing control on aeroplanes, often because of an excess of alcohol. And I think for the first time in all our years together, I'm going to turn that fascination into a topic after this.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, police have been urged to carry out an immediate review of the decision to ban Israeli football fans from an Aston Villa match. Maccabi Tel Aviv supporters have been told they can't attend next month's Europa League tie for safety reasons. The decision has been condemned by political leaders, including Sir Keir Starmer. But Ayub Khan, the independent MP for Birmingham Perry Bar, has told LBC that the ban should stand.
The experts say that there's a high risk and that they don't want the fans to come to the Villa Stadium. I respect that and I support that. But also there's a moral argument, and I've been very vocal in terms of my position. If we ban Russian football teams because they engaged in occupying Ukraine and the atrocities they are committing, well, Netanyahu's responsible for a genocide. And I think we need to have a moral equivalence.
Lord Mann, the independent advisor on anti-Semitism, has told LBC he is expecting the ban to be overturned.
I've dealt with both clubs on this over the last few months since this fixture was agreed. They're both very well-run clubs. Maccabi Tel Aviv played in London a few years ago at Chelsea. They played at Stoke in the north of England. And the demographics of Stoke are quite similar to Birmingham. There were no problems whatsoever.
Ofcom has sanctioned the BBC for breaching broadcasting rules in its Gaza How to Survive a War Zone documentary. The watchdog says a failure to disclose the narrator's links to Hamas was materially misleading. The independently made film was pulled in February after it emerged it was voiced by the son of a Hamas official. Three Nazi-worshipping extremists who met online have been jailed for plotting attacks on mosques and synagogues. They've been given sentences of between 8 and 10 years at Sheffield Crown Court. Alex Taylor Brown is there.
The court heard how amongst the targets for the group was an Islamic centre in Leeds. They'd amassed more than 200 weapons, including swords, a stun gun, crossbows, and had part 3D printed a semi-automatic weapon. Christopher Ringrodes from Cannock, Brogan Stewart from Wakefield, and Marco Pizzetto from Michelover were all found guilty of terror offences in May. They've been sentenced to a total of 29 years in prison. Alex Taylor Brown, LBC, Sheffield.
Stock markets across Europe have seen sharp falls after a similar sell-off in the US. There are growing concerns about millions of dollars of bad loans and alleged fraud at American regional banks. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was down 122, that's 1.3%, at 93.13. The pound buys $1.34 and a euro 14. LBC weather, cloudy this afternoon with patchy light rain for many. Sunny spells possible in southern and western areas. A high of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 4 minutes after 12 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. These stories are surprisingly common and there are some that pop up. What are your algorithms like? What's the weirdest thing that your algorithm throws up? That you sort of think, how has that happened? I've never expressed any interest whatsoever in this, but for some reason my algorithms, my social media algorithms are convinced that I'm fascinated by it. I went through a period of quite liking sort of banana skin clips, you know, when people fall off things. And then I had to stop that because it evolved into things where people were probably getting hurt. And that's not fun at all. You only like the ones where people aren't getting hurt. There's a bizarre, I told you this before, I've got a bizarre table tennis thing. And I love table tennis. There's this new shot, is it called the snake, where you kind of you bend down below the table and you do something magical with the bat and the ball goes back over the net and then comes back towards you before the other fella can even hit it. I can watch that stuff all day. And for some reason, and I think this is less mysterious perhaps, I get a lot of stuff of people misbehaving on aeroplanes. When things kick off on aeroplanes. There's another one I get. Now, this is really strange. So I have a terrible habit of buying clothes on Facebook. I sometimes see something on Facebook and I buy it and it arrives and it's, you know, two sizes too small or there's one garment that has become increasingly popular. And I mention this because I got two separate advertisements from two separate companies for it on Facebook yesterday. There's a very specific garment that I have taken an irrational hatred against. And you know, I know you wouldn't know it looking at me, but I used to work in menswear, and I have an abiding affection for the genre. I'm fascinated by a fancy clobber, a nice clobber. I just don't wear it anymore, except on very, very special occasions. But there's one garment that is now very commonplace among the sort of gentleman's outfitters that I follow on Facebook, and I hate it. I bet you can't guess what it is. I almost reached the point where I'm going to take against anyone who's wearing it. It's a very specific garment. I just need to check what Keith's wearing today. Stand up, mate. No, I've got a couple of those. They're fine. That's just a normal hoodie. This is more of a gentleman's outfitter issue. And I'm almost reaching the point now where I'm going to take against, not a gilet. I could have a problem, you know, like the little body warmers that very toffish. I love a cardigan. There's a very specific, this isn't the topic, by the way. And I love a shacket, as you well know. I wear little else these days. Anyway, I may tell you later in the programme. I may forget. That's why you stay tuned, isn't it? That's what you come here for. Those moments of tension and jeopardy that then deflate like a manky old balloon. But I am reaching the point where I could take against someone wearing one on entirely unfair and irrational grounds. 7 minutes after 12. But my algorithm also serves up. It's almost a topic in that. What is the weirdest thing your algorithm serves up that you genuinely have absolutely no interest in? But don't text me with that. Someone's got it right. That's extraordinary, Jenny. You know me so well. That's absolutely matter. Okay, we'll probably have to tell people a little bit later in the programme what it is. A woman on a long-haul flight assaulted her partner and spewed racist abuse at other passengers after drinking 15 cans of wine. See, these stories always contain a line like that. That's why they end up in the paper, because not only can they put 15 cans of wine in the headline, but if you're the Daily Mail, you can stick a line underneath it. It's an underlined 15 cans of wine. And that's a story you can't look away from. You're going to have a look. You know this fascination I have with the universal. Reason I love, for example, topics about shopping is because it's something that absolutely everybody has a constant ongoing relationship with. So the last hour, not a universal topic, even though everybody has at some point in their life been a child, spoiler alert, everybody has at some point in their life been a child or is a child. But you're not going to be in the zone of juggling parenting with work. You might have been in that zone once, you might be in that zone in the future, but it's not a universal. There aren't that many universals. When it comes to behaviour, shops are the perfect universal. And airplane travel is pretty close. Air travel is pretty close to a universal. Almost everybody's been on a plane. Most of us travel by plane relatively regularly. Don't at me, all right? You know what a plane is. That's enough. And the relationship that we have with aeroplanes is fascinating. Do you know what a liminal space is? One of my daughters was explaining it to me the other day in the context of King Lear, would you believe? I kind of knew. A liminal space is sort of in between places. So an airport is a liminal space. And you have a weird feeling in a liminal space. And an aeroplane itself, I think, can feel like a liminal space. Even though you're obviously going somewhere, you're not there yet. Until, of course, you are. And you have left the place that you're leaving, unless, of course, you haven't. But in between those two phenomena, the leaving and the arriving, where are you? Where are you? You're in a liminal space. You're in the air. And it makes us feel a bit different about things. And because you rarely spend that long that confined, you have these weird kind of imaginings. I, for example, sit in the airport. And this is not a reflection on obesity or anything like that, but I have an extraordinary capacity for knowing when someone particularly enormous comes into the departure lounge that they're going to be in the seat next to me. It doesn't always happen. And to be honest, on European flights, it's not that commonplace anyway. But if you're flying in the United States of America, there's a higher likelihood of somebody really, really big. Hey, no beef with them at all. But it does rather compromise the comfort of your air travel. And I'll say to Mrs. O'Brien, because she'll be in the window seat, I'll be in the aisle seat, I'll be in the middle seat, and he'll be in the aisle seat. She'll be in the aisle. It's happened about four times out of five over the years. And I don't know why, but you wouldn't feel like that on a train, or you wouldn't feel like that anywhere else, but you feel like that on an aeroplane. And then you're also very conscious of the other passengers' behaviour, because you know you're going to be cooped up for several hours. So even before the threat of terrorism was brought home to us by the events of September the 11th, you are very conscious, sort of weirdly meerkatty conscious of the other passengers. You're quite you know, you're quite vigilant, aren't you? You're quite aware of what the other passengers are up to. And if you are unfortunate enough to be travelling, for example, with a stag group or a hen group, and you wonder whether they're going to cross the line from amusing rowdiness into obnoxious misbehaviour, that is going to be for the next 3 hours. It's not just going to be until the next stop, or I'll get off early like you would on the tube or the train or the bus. You've got this. You cannot. There's something about knowing that you can't escape that I think speaks to our primal self. You always need to know where the escape route is. It's why they built forts on hills. It's why we feel actually and measurably more secure when we can see a long way into the distance. You know there's no threat coming. Something a bit weird. I mean, it's a bit like prison. You're getting cooped up. And if someone in that coop is behaving really badly, it's going to be much worse than it would be in almost any other context where someone nearby was behaving really badly, because you can't get rid of them and you can't get away. Which is why I think we all have an enduring fascination with stories about women embarking on foul-mouthed rampages after downing 15 cans of wine. I think you know where this is going, don't you? Would it be irresponsible? And obviously we're not going to make light of things like racist abuse, God forbid. But the idea that she started trying to have a conversation with those around her while being extraordinarily drunk, at which point everybody did what you would do, and you just pretend it's not happening, don't you? Because you're British and you're on an aeroplane. That's nice. I like your shoes. He's just going to stare ahead fixedly, hoping that she goes away. And of course she doesn't. She responds by going, you then. And then her partner tries to calm her down and she attacks him, tries to headbutt him, elbows him a few times and then punches him. He puts his arms up to protect himself and the cabin staff arrive. And then people do this stuff. I find this so obnoxious. She starts shouting at all the other passengers, I will be going back to my big house and you will be going back to your council houses. She then accused other passengers of kicking her seat and is alleged to have made racist remarks. What's it like? It's never happened to me. The worst I've had is either sitting next to somebody very big, or on a flight to Thailand, I had an armrest fight. I wish I'd never started it, to be honest with you, but because that's a long flight to Thailand. But what is it like to be on a plane? Chris says it's like Idiot's Corner with four walls. Oh, it's like ending up in Idiot's Corner when you're not an idiot, actually. Could you imagine how horrible that would be? What is it like to be on a plane? And when I say a competition, it was the worst thing. Within sort of the parameters of decency, what's it actually like to be on the plane? How much difference does it make to the job that the staff, the cabin crew, are trying to do? If you are cabin crew, what's the worst sort of scenario that you can find yourself in? I don't know how, because I fly quite a lot. Not quite as much as I did in the days before Greta Thunberg and the influence that she has had over the younger generations. But I still fly quite a lot, once a year, there and back, usually. Twice, give or take. And I'm just double-checking my memory banks. I've never had any proximity to or experience of the sort of stories that make the newspapers or end up on TikTok, where somebody is behaving appallingly on a plane. What happened when you were in that scenario? And what's it like? Especially, are cabin crew allowed to talk to me? You don't sign an Official Secrets Act, do you, or anything like that? I mean, what is the process? I mean, what are the priorities? What's the deal? What's the worst you've ever encountered? Some people, it's going to almost always involve alcohol and arguing and fighting, either between people who are travelling together or people picking fights with complete strangers. But I'm interested in, two things, really. Imagine, isn't it awful when you're on a public transport scenario and somebody's kicking off and they just decide that you're going to be the focus of their anger? I don't know that is, I mean, there's nothing funny about that, but dealing with it and watching it and the impact it has on you. What's it like to be stuck on an aeroplane when somebody like this woman downs 15 cans of wine and starts trying to start a fight with everybody who looks at her? 0345 6060 973. And I don't, I might be a little bit irresponsible to turn it into a competition, like the worst thing that's happened. Who's had the worst experience on a plane? No, let's do it. We are irresponsible. It's Friday. Who's had the single worst experience on a plane? Okay, about other people's bad behaviour, involving other people's bad behaviour. And the other bit that interests me is how it is dealt with. How I mean, I can't quite imagine what the job is. It's not like being a cop. Well, it is like being a copper, but you're not. So the single worst experience of other people's behaviour on an aeroplane and the challenge that it presents to either... Can other passengers get involved? The cabin crew discourage other passengers? I just want an idiot's guide. No, I don't. I want a comprehensive guide to what it's like when somebody else on your plane is auditioning for a part on TikTok or an appearance in the Daily Mail. 0345 6060 973. Oh, I just remembered the question. You could tell I had another question then that I was trying to remember, but I'd forgotten it briefly. What's the worst destination for this kind of behaviour? There's some quite obvious suggestions or ideas, but as a frequent flyer, or indeed as a member of cabin crew, what is the single destination that makes you go, oh, we're going to have trouble on this one? We're going to have trouble on this one. And the less immediately obvious it is, the more points you'll get. It's 12:18.
This is LBC. Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m.
I have found completely shocking the extent of the anti-Semitism that people have felt because of what's been going on in the Middle East, emboldened not just to criticise the Israeli government, but to use what is happening in the Middle East as a way of allowing you to expose what you really believe. And I think a lot of people have shown themselves for what they really are.
Tom Swarbrick with cybersecurity from BT. Security solutions built for businesses. LBC.
Do you know your state pension age? No. Maybe you're not sure, or you don't know how to check. It's so quick and easy to check online. All you need is your date of birth. Knowing your state pension age helps you think about your future. So check yours today. Search state pension age on gov.uk and simply enter your date of birth. State pension age. It's good to know.
That quiet moment behind the wheel. The perfect space to get your thoughts in order. With the stylish HRV Hybrid, you get the head-turning design you want with the space and flexibility you actually need. Because every journey matters. Explore the full Honda range online at honda.co.uk. Honda, the power of dreams.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Why didn't you show me that before? That's terrible. That's love. That's so Keith just said to me in my ear. He said, I'm just WhatsApping you the worst thing I saw on my flight to New York recently. And guess what it was? It was someone listening to the Full Disclosure podcast in the seat in front of him on an aeroplane. That's fame, that is, mate. Did you introduce yourself? Why not? Oh, fair enough. 20 minutes after 12 is the time. Woman's foul-mouthed rampage on jet as she downed 15 cans of wine. And something else occurred to me. Stuff that is awful that the rest of us won't immediately think of. So either you as a passenger had the unfortunate experience of something terrible, the worst thing to be stuck with on a plane that is not immediately obvious. Either cabin crew or passenger. But you go, no, it's not actually the drunk, violent person. One of the worst things that can happen is the what person. 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. Josh is in Epsom. Josh, what have you got?
Hi, James, how are you?
Very
you
well, mate. Yes, very well indeed. What
good
happened?
Stuff. I've got quite a few recently.
Really?
I've had three in the last year.
Okay. Is it? I mean, I can only think of one recurring theme in these three events, Josh, and that's you.
Maybe I should drive everywhere. Anyway, So my stag do back in May, we had a lovely golf weekend in Marbella.
Right.
You fly to Malaga for this, and you also fly to Malaga to go to Benidorm.
Yes.
On the way back, we were in the airport after a very relaxed golfing weekend, and there were these women and their late teen daughters, all drunk about 2 in the afternoon, screaming, getting duty free, and we all looked at each other, and I said, oh, I bet they're on our flight. Of course they were. One of the very drunk women.
How drunk? Scale of 1 to 10.
Oh, well, good. 9, 10.
So, I mean, questionable whether she should have been allowed onto the plane at all.
Drinking cans of cocktails in the departure lounge.
Yeah.
She went to the bathroom and proceeded to throw up all over the bathroom.
On the plane, this is, not on the departure lounge.
On the plane, yep, sorry, on the plane. So the air hostess subsequently shut down all of the bathrooms for the rest of the flight. Fortunately, it was only a 2.5 hour, 3 hour flight, so it wasn't too bad, but that was that one.
I hadn't thought of that. You see, that's kind of what I meant about not necessarily being the behaviour, the obvious behaviour, but coating, pebble dashing one of the lavatories, mm-hmm. and then presumably you could smell it, could you, if you were nearby?
Oh, yeah.
You were that, well, not even if you were nearby. Eventually, on a plane, you could smell everything.
Yeah, circulates, which is what Sheila Fogarty said a couple of weeks ago about should they serve alcohol on planes or not.
It's a good question, except that our tickets would go up quite significantly if they weren't making a few quid out of selling. And you can't really justify selling anyone 15 cans of wine if she drank them all on the plane, can you? But equally, those people you're describing were plastered before they got on the plane, by the sounds of it. Go on, give me the other one.
The other two. So going to your...
Well, I might only have time for one. There's a queue here, Josh. There's a lot of people waiting. So make sure, I hope you started with the best one and worked your way down, and not the other way around. Go on, then.
The larger people, there's a flight in America, a company in America in the New Year might be charging for 2 seats. I flew to the States and we were in a row of 3 and next to me was a very large woman and I hadn't paid for my seats, didn't want to pay the expense, but at the back of longer plane or bigger planes that do long haul where it tapers, there are 2s. And yes. I flew with my wife and we now only fly in the 2s.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
They're not next to one of them.
Yes, I don't want to sound like we're fat shaming or bullying people.
Oh, no,
but no,
not.
I know you're not. I started it. I'm just clarifying that for the avoidance of doubt. But I did actually witness somebody paying for 2 seats on an aeroplane, again on an internal flight within the United States of America. I like that. I love my listeners. You know that I do. But just for the avoidance of doubt, you're more likely to fly to Alicante if you're going to Benidorm than Malaga. I'm glad we've cleared that up. That was the most important element, I thought, of Josh's contribution. Louise is in Brighton. Louise, what made you pick up the phone?
Oh, hi, James. First time caller here, so apologies if I'm a bit nervous.
But you won't be, though. Everyone always says that, and they never are. Because do you know why, Louise? I have an extraordinary capacity for putting people at their ease.
Oh, thank you. I've been cabin crew for 25 years, so I've seen a fair amount.
Yes.
My worst ever experience was flying home from Marrakesh. We had a couple on board who we believe had taken drugs. They got extremely aggressive on the flight, shouting, trying to smoke in the toilets, screaming obscenities in my face.
Oh, Lord.
Punching the sort of aircraft.
What do you do? What's the? I mean, I don't want you to tell me anything you're not supposed to tell me, but I can't see why there would be any secrecy surrounding this. How does it escalate? Do you have code words? Does the pilot announce that something like they do in department stores when they say, "Would Mr. Jones please make his way to haberdashery?" And that means that there's a shoplifter on the second floor or something like that. Do you have anything?
Not really. No. I mean, you have to kind of gauge how the situation's escalating,
yes.
And you obviously have to keep the pilots informed. As it turns out, as I was trying to speak to the pilots, they could actually hear what was going on in the background, so they could tell.
Were you
how
scared?
It was. I was, yeah.
That's when it's not funny. That's when it stops being funny, because violent aggression, even if it doesn't turn physical, is traumatising, isn't it?
No, yeah, absolutely. And then they were very threatening myself and my family. They were saying they were part of a Irish cartel family that they were going to get me. So it's quite nasty. Luckily, we had quite a few passengers who helped. We didn't need to ask for any help.
How does that manifest itself? What does help look like? What should I do if I'm in that situation witnessing what was happening to you?
Well, we were very lucky. We had an off-duty Met police officer.
Oh, I'll leave it to him then. That's an easy answer. I'll hold your coat. I'll hold his coat. Go on.
Yeah. You just kind of have to talk them down, really, and kind of don't show any aggression back.
Yes. Yes, of course. That
he obviously knew what he was doing.
And he stepped up. He stepped up.
He did, yeah. We were very lucky to have him and a couple of other people on board as well. We did have to divert to get them off.
Wow. You've got to be off your nut not to realise that that's a point of no return, haven't you? We're actually flying to a different airport. They wouldn't have been even aware of it, would they?
No, they were completely unaware. You could tell because nothing was said until the very last moment that we were diverting. And even then, I don't think they realised.
No, they probably not to mean they when they woke up. What did everyone cheer when they got taken off the plane?
They did. There were many claps, applauses.
this is what my TikTok's full of. And this is an odd question, and I'm sorry you had to go through that. And I'm sure you've been through plenty of other things as well, albeit that this was the worst, not least because the sense of threat was very real. But does it bring the rest of the passenger manifest together in a way that wouldn't otherwise ordinarily happen? Is the rest of the flight more upbeat than it would have been otherwise? Or not?
I wouldn't.
No, all right. I'm just being romantic. I'm just being romantic.
No,
I just quite like the idea of it being upbeat.
I've got some stories about that as well, but we won't go down that.
Oh,
route
you mean
today.
Things getting too romantic?
Oh no! People being asking for things when there's things going on that are quite obvious.
Oh my days! Now that's quite enough of that. Thank you, matron. 27 minutes after 12 is the time. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Simon Marks is in the building for a little catch up with some of the events in America, which we'll do after the next news bulletin. I mean, he's been on quite a few long haul flights himself. I wonder if they've ever had to divert to get him off the plane. Michelle's in Dundee. Michelle, what would you like to say?
Yeah, I think my story's a little bit more lighthearted.
Go on.
Hi, James. About 20 years ago, I was on a flight to South Africa, and it was a work trip. There was quite a large number of my work colleagues on this flight, but I didn't necessarily know all of them.
Yes.
We got put in these seats, and behind us were a couple of kids kicking seats, so we'd asked to be moved, and luckily we were able to be moved.
Yes.
But little did we know, we were then placed behind the Phantom Farter, and it was this guy who clearly had a terrible problem with wind, it was like gag-worthy. It was horrible.
For the whole flight?
Was sitting next to him, the whole flight, 11 hours. So as it went on, I was getting more and more angry. I was like, there's no need for this. You know, you could go to the toilet and do that. You don't need to do that in the seat. So anyway, when we got to the other end, thankfully the flight was over, and we came out into arrivals. And there's a guy standing there with the name of my company on a placard kind of thing. And we all made our way towards him, and the Phantom Farter was in our group.
Here we go. There you go. He's your new boss, and you've been married for 27 years.
No.
I don't know. I like that phrase. I do like that phrase. It reminds me, people of my age, probably of the Phantom Flanflinger from Tiswas. But that is it. I wouldn't have thought of that. Now you mention it, that would be absolutely gross. Count your lucky stars. I've never had that one either. It's coming up to 12:30. We are, it's Friday. Sometimes we dial it down a bit at 12 o'clock on a Friday, particularly when the rest of the news agenda has been very heavy. A woman on a long-haul flight assaulted her partner and spewed racist abuse, nothing funny about that, at other passengers after drinking 15 cans of wine. 15 cans of wine! I'm surprised she had the capacity physically, let alone emotionally. But it is those moments when you realise, oh my God, not only am I stuck with this, but I'm stuck with this all the way to Johannesburg or all the way to Bangkok. 12:30 is the time. Amelia Cox has your headlines.
Downing Street says discussions are happening at pace to resolve a ban on Israeli fans attending a football game in Birmingham. Number 10 says the Prime Minister will do everything in his power to ensure Jewish people are safe. The BBC has been sanctioned by Ofcom for breaching broadcasting rules in a documentary on Gaza. The watchdog says a failure to disclose the narrator's links to Hamas was materially misleading. And Volodymyr Zelensky and Donald Trump will meet at the White House later. They're expected to discuss the possibility of the US supplying Ukraine with long-range Tomahawk missiles. LBC weather, a cloudy day for much of the UK. Some light rain and drizzle developing in the far north, east and south. A few sunny breaks in places, a high of 17 degrees.
LBC.
Fraud can happen faster than you think. But at Barclays, we use innovative technology that spots fraud in under a second. And our dedicated team of experts work 24/7. So you can go about your day knowing we never stop working to keep you and your money safe. Search Barclays Fraud Protection to see how you can stay one step ahead. Barclays, make money work for you.
Hi, we're Travel Essence, experts in tailor-made holidays to Australia and New Zealand. We craft personal, authentic journeys that take it slow and truly connect you with the land, where you walk in the footsteps of ancient ancestors, soak up Indigenous culture, and uncover the unspoiled essence of Down Under. Travelessence.co.uk. Go deeper, Down Under.
Welcome our new bookworms to the club. Now, do you read traditional books or e-books?
Oh, real books.
Traditional, yeah. Always.
Yeah, quite.
I read e-books. I adjust it so the font's huge.
Ooh, they make large font books.
Think bigger. Imagine Moby Dick all cuddled up with a book. His font size.
Oh, my goodness.
Maybe it's time for varifocals. At Specsavers, get 2-for-1 varifocal glasses from £110. Conditions and exclusions apply. See online for details.
Have you noticed the way fans shout at football matches?
Oh, wake up!
That's because conveying your message with sound is the most effective way to communicate to the players on the pitch that they're rubbish. And this works in advertising too. You see, research shows how brands that use radio to amplify their advertising are 49% more likely to get noticed. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Very occasionally, I'll get a text that I can almost... It almost comes with an accent. You read it. No spelling mistakes, no demotic, and nothing like that, but it almost sort of has an accent. Joseph in North London, I don't know how you speak, but I have a sort of Leslie Phillips-type accent buzzing away in the back of my brain. Joseph's been in touch to say, anyone who drinks wine from a can should have their passport withdrawn. Ding dong. And before Simon Marks talks us through at least three developments in the United States this week that I just worry that you might not be aware of. I thought we've got time to do a quick missed information, I think.
Missed information.
Thank you, Emily. This is a correction and clarification in the Daily Telegraph from earlier this week. I'm just going to read it to you in its entirety in case you ever think that I'm exaggerating when I tell you that they just don't care what they print anymore, these people, particularly when Nigel Farage is involved. Ready? The articles, Farage, I'll kick out hundreds of thousands, and Boris Wave has brought Britain to brink of financial disaster, September the 22nd, stated the cost of 800,000 Boris Wave migrants gaining indefinite leave to remain will be at least £234 billion during their lifetimes. I actually read that, and I thought, where the hell did they get that number from? That is absolute hogwash. Utter nonsense, especially when you look at the statistical evidence demonstrating the likelihood of a person coming here to work being a net contributor to our economy over the course of their lifetime rather than a net drain. Most obviously because they don't have 18 years worth of educational expenses to absorb. This figure, they've got around to publishing in an article approximately one millionth the size of the two that they are correcting and clarifying. This figure was from a third-party organisation which has confirmed it is disputed and will be updated. We are happy to correct the record. That's what counts as an apology for lying to you or for completely misleading you in a national newspaper these days. Made-up numbers. Oh, sorry. They're from a third party. They say it's disputed. We will be updated. We're happy to correct the record. I'll tell you who won't be correcting the record. The bloke in the headline. You can take that to the bank.
Missed information.
Thank you, Emily. Where do we start, Simon Marks?
Well, there's a lot to talk about. I mean, we could start with... where would you like to start with? How the White House is treating the Democrats, perhaps?
Well, we've got a clip on that, and this ties in with something I talk about quite a lot on the programme, which is the invention of enemies. The fact that, it happens in this country, they start talking about the radical left copying Donald Trump, and you say, well, who do you mean? Who are these people? And why haven't I been invited to their get-togethers and their parties? These are largely non-existent groups, but I've never heard it quite as bad as Caroline Leavitt, the press secretary at the White House, made it yesterday.
The Democrat Party's main constituency are made up of Hamas terrorists, illegal aliens, and violent criminals. That is who the Democrat Party is catering to, not the Trump administration and not the White House and not the Republican Party, who is standing up for law-abiding Americans, not just across the country, but around the world.
So, I mean, off the top of your head, how many votes did the Democrats get at the last election?
72. 2 million, 73 million?
72 million people who fall into this category. Same clip.
The Democrat Party's main constituency are made up of Hamas terrorists, illegal aliens, and violent criminals. That is who the Democrat Party is catering to, not the Trump administration and not the White House and not the Republican Party, who is standing up for law-abiding Americans, not just across the country, but around the world.
So, I mean, to be facetious for a moment, if there are 72 million Hamas terrorists, violent criminals and illegal aliens in the United States of America, leaving aside, of course, the fact that the illegal aliens wouldn't be able to vote, they're not doing a very good job of keeping the country safe, are they?
Look, I think that this is a really serious trajectory yeah. on which the White House has placed itself over the last 3 months. It was 2.5 months ago when Stephen Miller, the Deputy White House Chief of Staff, the chief ideologue of the Make America Great Again movement and Donald Trump's really right-hand man in terms of philosophy, first described the Democratic Party as a domestic extremist organization. And that was the canary in the coal mine, because in the 2.5 months since then, the language has become increasingly virulent, increasingly embraced use of the word terrorist to describe the radical left, by which they absolutely mean the Democrats.
So the late Jimmy Carter, for example.
The late Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, and critically, as they begin to prepare to root out the funders and supporters of the Democratic Party, people like George Soros, whose Open Society Foundation is absolutely in the crosshairs of criminal investigation now, as are other prominent left-wing and progressive organizations that will be falsely accused of funding what the Trump White House claims is an insurrection. And where all of this is inexorably leading to is the president invoking the Insurrection Act of 1807. He said now on multiple occasions he may have no alternative but to do it. You know, someone hold me back, stop me from doing it. He'll invoke the Insurrection Act of 1807 in order to claim that the future of the republic is threatened by a violent terrorist uprising by radical left Democrats, by which he means Democrats who are taking to the streets of cities like Chicago and cities like Portland and are protesting the thuggish actions of his masked immigration and customs enforcement agents who are pulling people off the streets, breaking into people's homes. We're going to have an example of that this afternoon on American Week at 10 to 6. Took place in Oregon earlier this week.
Oh, yes.
Where doors were broken down, seemingly by ICE agents who had no warrant, no constraints on their activities, as far as now. Now, pulling people off the streets, racially profiling them, scores of them turn out to be US citizens who then have to spend days, if not weeks, trying to battle to be returned to their families and allowed out of ICE detention centers.
I'm going to pause there because that, again, and every time I talk to you, I find that I have to do this. People may not realize that is happening. People are being locked up. People are being taken away, locked up. Guilty until proven innocent, and they are American citizens. And so the criteria under which they've been incarcerated is looking a little bit non-WASP.
The people that are being pulled off the streets by the confession of the head of Border Patrol are being racially profiled. If you look Latino, if you look like you come from somewhere south of the border, if you're driving around in a car and when the ICE agents see you, they see the white knuckles, you know, because they sense that you're suddenly concerned that they might be coming after you. That is enough now for ICE to stop the car on occasion, even to drive into the vehicle to try and pin it and prevent it from moving. They haul these people out. They have no idea who they are. And then they take them away. And only after they take them away do they begin processing them. We've got to the point now where in the last couple of weeks, in some parts of the country, people are being asked to produce their papers. And I didn't know this.
Go on.
I'm a green card holder. I'm not an American citizen, so I'm a permanent legal resident of the United States. By law, which I did not know until I read about this 10 days ago, I am required to carry my green card with me. Now, because of the nature of my job, I always do, because I never know when I'm going to have to go somewhere. But There are lots of people that wouldn't be doing that naturally. So if they haul me across, you know, and take me away, I can immediately reach into my pocket and say, there's my green card. You know, you got nothing on me. But if you don't have the capacity to produce your papers now, your visa to show that you've got one, your green card to show that you're a legal permanent resident, or potentially your passport to show that you're a US citizen, they'll take you away. And so we've reached the show me your papers stage of this authoritarian government.
I don't know what words to use anymore, because every time you come in, we talk about the ratcheting up or the seriousness of it or the increasing absence of any sort of leavening factors or reasons to be cheerful. I don't think there are any, not least if you are a journalist who has been working at the Pentagon for 20 years.
Yes, well, absolutely. I mean, we are now at a point where for the first time since 1943, since the first time since that iconic Pentagon-shaped complex opened, there are no accredited members of the press covering events in that building. As a result of changes that Pete Hegseth, the man we must now call the Secretary of War, decided to implement with regards to the activities of journalists who have covered things going on at the Pentagon and monitored how it spends $1 trillion in taxpayer money every year, Hegseth said that if they wanted to stay, they had to promise that anything that they were going to publish needed to be sent to the Pentagon press office for authorization, first of all. I mean, this is like going back to, you know, Good Morning Vietnam stuff. That they were not allowed to attempt to inveigh anyone in the building to leak information to them, nor, it seemed by one reading of these rules, even necessarily allowed to go and talk to retired generals and get their views on what's taking place inside the building. And this is coming, James, at a time when the United States has been engaged in extrajudicial killings in the Caribbean, six separate speedboats that we have to take on trust from Pete Hegseth really were engaged in the business of drug trafficking narcotics to the United States.
They could share intelligence if they wanted to, and if they had it.
They could have come forward and provided all sorts of proof to back up their claims.
But as
they
it
could,
is, they're just blowing speedboats.
They're just blowing speedboats out of the water, and this week Donald Trump saying that he might start launching airstrikes on Venezuelan soil as well. Yeah. They don't even pretend to have a legal justification for any of this. The legal justification is apparently we've got to save American lives from Venezuelan drug traffickers, and therefore we'll do anything that we want to do in order to do it. So the Pentagon accredited journalists have all refused to sign these new rules of the road, and they've all left the building.
What does that mean?
It means that Pete Hegseth is presiding over a Pentagon that is not now receiving any scrutiny from inside the building.
But they'll be able to carry on doing the job.
Yes, from outside the building.
I see.
But you won't be able to see things that are happening. You won't be able to sit in a briefing room and be briefed by the Pentagon press secretary or by Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of War.
The obvious question is, why would anybody be so terrified of scrutiny? To which the answer ties in with your first topic today, and that is because they're doing terrible things.
Well, it's all about total disdain for accountability. Mm. If you've watched the performance of Hegseth and the Attorney General Pam Bondi when they've been brought before congressional committees, they are required to testify to Congress. Remember, it's Congress that approved their nominations and appointed them into these cabinet positions. They treat, obviously mostly Democrats in Congress, with utter disdain, but they treat the process of accountability and transparency with disdain. So, you know, some veteran Pentagon correspondents are arguing that Pete Hegseth doesn't understand what he's losing. He's losing this conduit to communicate with millions of Americans about what the Pentagon is doing every day. I don't think Pete Hegseth cares about that. I think he just wants to get on with it. With the doors closed, nobody around to look and see what's going on, and everybody having to stand outside the building trying to work out what's happening inside it rather than being inside it and getting a sense of what is taking place.
We talk about the language, don't we? Fascism, racism, all of those things. There's a development in the world of refugees that is, I mean, about as close to apartheid era South Africa as it's imagined, as it's currently possible to imagine a 21st century American policy being.
Well, it looks like this is where we're heading. So the White House has been sent proposals that have been leaked and have been seen by reporters by both the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security, completely to remake refugee policy. Now, it's already been partly remade because at the moment America's doors are closed to virtually all refugees except for white Afrikaner farmers from South Africa who will falsely claim, because this hasn't happened, that their land has been taken by the South African government without compensation. And just to be clear, there is a new law. There are circumstances under which the South African government could expropriate land without compensation, but it's never done it. Never done it once to a single farmer.
And it's very popular on certain social media sites. This mythology of black people stealing stuff from white people.
Absolutely, and it's fueled by right-wing media in the United States that has Donald Trump's ear. So we've seen the evisceration of the bilateral relationship between the United States and South Africa over the last few months. The plan now is to embed this notion within official US government refugee policy and to say that moving forward, in fact, refugee status should be largely protected for people who can claim political, particularly free speech, persecution in Europe, other parts of the world with predominantly white populations. This is moving completely away from the notion of bring me your tired, your huddled masses, as represented by the Statue of Liberty. This is moving to a point, and it should really worry number 10, that America's doors may be open to all of those people that we know have found sympathy within the corridors of Donald Trump's White House. We've seen the Tate brothers, of course, spend a bit of time in Florida. There will be others that may soon find themselves being afforded refugee status by a U.S. government that is no longer interested in helping, for example, the victims of the conflict in Sudan.
And, of course, you won't have to prove anything if you're on this list. You won't have to prove persecution. You won't have to prove that your freedom of speech has been in any way curtailed. You'll just have to say that it has and have enough followers on social media to be helpful to the White House's mission.
Well, the bar's very low already because the South African
just got to be white.
Situation is sort of making the case. I mean, you do have to go through a process in South Africa,
sure,
but it's based on a falsehood.
So you can get locked up for absolutely no reason whatsoever if you are Hispanic, and you can achieve refugee status for no reason whatsoever if you are white.
Absolutely.
There should be a word for that kind of attitude, shouldn't there? It's just on the tip of my tongue. When are you heading back?
Next weekend.
Okay.
How are you feeling about that? I'm a very privileged person. I have the capacity to come and go for as long as they allow me to come and go. I am able to do my work on both sides of the Atlantic, and I'm very lucky and grateful for that. So, I'm very committed to being there and observing events in the United States as a foreign pair of eyes, an international observer of what is taking place, even though next year will be my 33rd year there. I still feel very much an outsider, not an insider. And I'm going to carry on doing that for as long as I can in sort of time-honored fashion. And if it becomes impossible to do it, well, it becomes impossible to do it.
But I
don't think we're at that point yet, hopefully.
Final question, one I've probably asked you before, is the stuff that you report to us, and I work in London, I rely on international media and to an increasing extent, actually, some of the outlets that I access via Blue Sky. Is the urgency present in the States? On the other side of the aisle, the people that will be as repulsed by all the things you've just discussed as we are not as exercised by it or as aware of it as they should be?
Well, they're exercised, particularly at a grassroots level, which is why you're seeing what you're seeing in Chicago and Portland and other cities across the country. But they're leaderless. They are absolutely rudderless. And there's hardly
And the
any...
media has been cowed. A lot of the media has been cowed. Just evicted from the Pentagon, bought by allies of Donald Trump.
Right, and if you look at what's happened at the Pentagon, it's perfectly possible that that may eventually happen at the White House as well.
Yeah.
Already, as you and I have talked about before, the White House press corps has been swelled by all of these polemicists who suddenly have a place at the table that they would never have been given before. A very good piece in The New Yorker that's just come out today by Susan Glasser about the state of the current White House press corps and where it may be heading. And of course, you know, the media behemoths, CBS bent the knee, ABC now being taken over essentially by MAGA sympathizers. ABC bent the knee, the Washington Post completely eviscerated as any kind of respectable journalistic outlet anymore after Jeff Bezos and Will Lewis bent the knee to Trump. I mean, it's not what it used to be.
It is impossible to exaggerate. And, I mean, you say polemicist. Others might say white supremacist liars have got the upper hand in so many corners of this administration and, indeed, this profession, the media profession. Simon, we're incredibly late for the break, which is a testament to how brilliant you always are. Anything you haven't touched on, you will be touching on later on Tom Swarbrick's show with your weekly roundup at 10 to 6. But in the meantime, Godspeed and thank you.
Thanks, James.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
What does the decision to bar Maccabi fans from their team's away game with Aston Villa tell us? Have police bowed to the mob or secured the streets?
Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
At TfL, we're helping to make bus journeys greener. Our entire bus fleet is 100% low or zero emission at the tailpipe, including those for our Superloop routes, helping improve air quality for all. And we'll have a fully zero-emission fleet by 2034. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. Holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
The world is vast, offering endless possibilities. But Claire's world has only been getting smaller. She doesn't leave the country. She barely leaves the house. Still traumatized by that roadside bomb in Iraq. More than 20 years ago. For many, the battle continues. Combat Stress provides intensive mental health treatment to UK veterans with complex mental health problems, helping them rediscover the world they once knew. Combat Stress, for veterans' mental health. Search Combat Stress to support our work.
That quiet moment behind the wheel. The perfect space to get your thoughts in order.
With the stylish HR-V Hybrid, you get the head-turning design you want with the space and flexibility you actually need. Because every journey matters. Explore the full Honda range online at honda.co.uk. Honda, the power of dreams.
Imagine the varifocal lens of the future, personalized to you, engineered with artificial intelligence and powered by your visual behavior. Experience instantly sharp vision in motion with Varilux XR Pro lenses from Essilor. Find your local optician at essilor.com and ask for Varilux XR Pro.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
It is 12:55 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I should tell you, shouldn't I? And I wish I hadn't told you in the first place that I've developed an irrational hatred of a certain garment. But I did tell you that, and now I have to tell you what garment it is, and I'm going to upset all the people who wear them. They're probably perfectly nice people, although, frankly, I find that very hard to believe. Have you seen those? They didn't exist when I was younger. Like a woolen jumper, but with a zip on the like going down about a third or a quarter of the way down the front. What's that? What is that about? You know, buy a jumper or buy a cardigan. Don't buy a flipping sort of weird hybrid. I don't know why I've taken against it so violently, but I don't know that I could ever truly trust anybody who wore one. I've never seen Alexander Armstrong wearing one. He is one of the best dressed men in the building. I stroll past him every day when I'm on my way to see you, and he is about to address the audience on Classic FM, and I'm delighted to say that he is the guest on this week's Full Disclosure, and I didn't know him very well. You know, we are ships that pass in the morning. But he is such a lovely man, and this is such a delightful conversation. And all the Full Disclosures lately have been utterly, utterly joyous. But this clip goes back to his childhood at boarding school. Prep school in the 70s, learning Latin from a teacher who hurled bald rubbers all over the place. But the music that came to typify much of his life, and indeed the way in which these kind of educations can affect us all. What were you good at apart from music?
I was good at English. I think I was eventually good at most things. I was very good at Latin. That was the thing I really enjoyed. Very, very logical and very,
well,
very
it's
strictly.
Part puzzle and part poetry, Latin.
It is really, yeah. It is exactly that. It's sort of cryptic and satisfying. And actually brilliantly taught by this. I mean, God, if I look back over the dramatis personae of the staff room at a Northumbrian prep school in the 70s. Yes. I mean, what a melange. There were some brilliant people in there. But we had this...
Some eccentric.
Psychopath who used to teach us... who used to teach us Latin. Who used to... He would... I mean, he would just hurl board rubbers.
Yeah.
If he thought someone wasn't paying attention, boom!
At full speed.
This
is a lump of wood. It's not a sponge. I don't want anyone to get the wrong idea.
No, lump of wood with a bit of felt woven into it. You know, it was... You had no choice but to learn. But, yeah, it was... It was good. Once the brutality, and actually, I sort of trace some of my phobias and weird quirks of personality. They inevitably, I think, all probably go back to that time, that first year, particularly at prep school.
Were you beaten?
I don't think I ever particularly was. I was threatened once with the cane.
Right, because they're very different schools. I mean, everyone uses it as a generic term, but some of them were hideously violent.
Some of them were.
Others less so.
I was slippered once, though.
Right.
Really, really unfairly, yeah.
So you didn't live in fear, then? A lot of people in those schools sometimes do live in a form of fear.
I don't know. I mean, I have... Yeah. My default position on other people, generally, is to be initially quite scared of them.
Is it?
Okay. I have a fear of...
Yeah.
One expects the worst somehow of people. And it's always such a lovely surprise when you discover people are really nice.
Usually.
You think,
usually.
Yeah. You know, but they, in 99% of cases,
of course.
You're pulled up occasionally by some. But it means, I mean, in a funny way, I think I'm generally very positively and optimistically disposed.
Mm.
And I'm sure it's probably because day-to-day life is always so much nicer than I think I might have imagined it.
I wonder why that is, then.
I don't know why.
School was nice. It wasn't...
School was okay, but I think the other boys were... Eventually, they were great.
Sure, but there's always...
But there's always... I think you have a fear of what other people are, which
what's
far
going to
exceeds...
Happen next.
Yeah.
It was a form of hypervigilance, isn't it?
I think that's right.
I just loved that conversation. A really, really lovely guy. And guess who I had yesterday? Charles Dance, or Charles in Kentish Town, as I shall always think of him, and I hope that he rings into the show one day, because I discovered that he listens to it. That's a treat as well. But Alexander Armstrong this week is the Full Disclosure guest, and that is it from me for this week. You can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date on all the top stories and opinions, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts, including James O'Brien Daily, the best bits from this show every day. Download it, the LBC app, for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Swarbrick, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
That was quick. Thanks, James. Have a good afternoon. Good weekend.
Terms and conditions apply.
Football fan bans have been a commonplace public order tool all over Europe and here in the UK for decades. That said, is now 2 weeks after anti-Semitic murder at a Manchester synagogue and everything that came before that, the moment to bar Israeli or UK fans of Maccabi Tel Aviv, or Maccabi Tel Aviv, I'm told it's pronounced, from an away game at Villa Park. The Prime Minister says talks are happening at pace, was his term, across government over the police decision to bar the fans. Have they surrendered to the mob, the police, or have they simply secured the streets and saved people from harm?
on your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. Discussions are said to be happening at pace across government to resolve a ban on fans of an Israeli football team in Birmingham. Maccabi Tel Aviv supporters have been told they can't attend next month's Europa League tie for safety reasons. Downing Street says Sir Keir Starmer wants to do everything in his power to ensure Jewish people feel safe in the UK. Tory leader Kemi Badenoch says the ban is a national disgrace.
This is something that the police should be able to deal with. We cannot be a country where we tell Jewish people that they can't come to watch football because their security is not going to be looked after. What I want to see is the police finding ways to make sure they can be secure and sending the message to the Islamists and those who are pushing anti-Jewish hatred that this does not happen in the UK. Britain has always been a sanctuary for Jews and it always should be.
Palestine Action's co-founder can proceed with a High Court challenge against the group's ban as a proscribed organisation. Judges dismissed an appeal by the Home Office to dismiss the case. The ban, which began in July, made membership of or support for the group a criminal offence punishable by up to 14 years. Manchester Arena bomber bomb plotter Hashem Abedi has denied attacking prison officers at a maximum security prison. The 28-year-old appeared at the Old Bailey via video link. He's accused of using hot cooking oil and makeshift weapons in the attack on four guards at HMP Frankland in April. President Zelensky will make the case for US-supplied long-range missiles when he meets Donald Trump later. The two leaders are due to discuss the war in Ukraine at the White House. Kira Rudik is a Ukrainian MP.
We really hope that President Trump, being so happy about resolving situation in the Middle East, will finally start applying pressure on Russia.
Mr. Trump has agreed to meet his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin in Hungary in the coming weeks. And the King will become the first British monarch to pray at a public service with the Pope since the Reformation. Charles will make the state visit to the Vatican next week. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 103 points at 93.33. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.14. LBC weather, a cloudy day for much of the UK. Some light rain and drizzle developing in the far north, east and south. A few sunny breaks in places, a high of 17 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. As you probably heard in the news bulletin just there, the Prime Minister has said that conversations are happening at pace, as he put it, to resolve the Maccabi Tel Aviv decision about fans being banned from attending a football game against Aston Villa next month, an away game from the Maccabi perspective. Downing Street said, well, the Prime Minister explicitly said yesterday it's a wrong decision. The Tory party leader, Kemi Badenoch, condemned the decision from West Midlands Police to bar Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from that game due to take place next month.
I think it is a national disgrace. This is something that the police should be able to deal with. We cannot be a country where we tell Jewish people that they can't come to watch football because their security is not going to be looked after. What I want to see is the police finding ways to make sure they can be secure and sending the message to the Islamists and those who are pushing anti-Jewish hatred that this does not happen in the UK. Britain has always been a sanctuary for Jews and it always should be.
Well, the Prime Minister yesterday spoke at the Community Security Trust, the CST as it's often called, about the government's plan to combat anti-Semitism.
We're putting in an additional £10 million
for the protection of the Jewish community. We want to work with you on that, to really step up the work that the government is doing, and to make sure that every single member of our Jewish community in this country feels safe, secure, and that this is where their home is. This is the country they are part of, and it's our job to make sure that that is absolutely reflected in a deep sense of security.
That was the Prime Minister yesterday. Dr. Dave Rich joins me, Head of Policy at the Community Security Trust, the author of Everyday Hate, How Anti-Semitism is Built into Our World and How You Can Change It. Good afternoon to you. Oh, my apologies, I didn't open your mic. Hello, Dave, thanks for joining me. Good afternoon to you.
Hi, good afternoon.
Is this different in nature, in your view, from fan bans that we've seen before, both foreign fans and indeed in some case home games between two UK sides?
I think it is different because the reasoning that's been given for the ban doesn't appear to be based on a fear that the visiting supporters are going to cause so much trouble the police can't handle it. And it also doesn't even seem to be a concern about what the match-going Aston Villa fans might do in the stadium. It seems to be much more related to what might happen in the surrounding area, in the kind of broader atmosphere from the wider local community, rather than people actually going to the match. And I think that's what makes this very different. And of course, because it has come off the back of a quite sustained political campaign led by the local MP and backed up by all sorts of activists locally.
To stop them from coming
for what appear very much to be political reasons.
In what way is it obvious that they're political reasons and not reasons of security and reasons based on the behaviour of some, and I stress some, Maccabi fans historically?
I think if you look at the reasons that have been given by the police for the ban, it's based very much on how people in the surrounding area might react, and it's a safety concern based on that. But West Midlands Police, you know, they police high-risk matches at Villa Park all the time. I've been to lots of high-risk matches at Villa Park. The police know what they're doing, and I'm sure they could police this match safely if the correct resources are put into place. So it's hard to avoid thinking that the political campaign behind this has had some influence on the decision.
People, I'm telling you stuff you know, Dave, but some people have been referring back to events in Amsterdam last November when a group of Ajax fans, or apparently Ajax fans, basically ran amok attacking Maccabi fans in Amsterdam. What nobody seems to be mentioning, I think it's important to put this into the mix, is that the court cases that were heard after that, and some people were jailed for short periods of time because of it, but in the court cases, it was clear that at least part of that series of attacks had been pre-planned, organised, on a WhatsApp group containing 900 people. That makes it a lot more sinister than just a bit of fan argy-bargy, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. And the thing that was